Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. All right. Well, it's going to be a busy day today. It's going to be a really busy day today. In fact, I'm just making some notes and stuff and kind of trying to get organized here. But we've got a lot going on, so I'm going to have to add another bit to my stuff here. So let me just do this here. And Bill Fecky is going to return for a visit for us at 7 o'clock. So it's going to be. Let me see. I'm just writing a couple things in here. Don't mind me. Sometimes I'm ready for the show. Sometimes not. This morning, not. Well, that's okay. We'll care on anyway. So we've got about half an hour, Gene and I, to kind of talk over all the stuff that's happening. We've got Sydney Cagle's going to join us at 6:30, Citizens for Medical Freedom. This is her organization. We'll be talking about that. We've got Bill Fecky who's going to join us at 7. We've got 7:30, Jonathan Buckley with the Legal Report, and 8:15, Claire Lopez with the Intelligence Report. So that's 4 people. So normally, actually, the last few days has been Gene and I have had a lot of chance to really kind of go over the issues. Not today. Gene, we're kind of sitting back today. We have a lot of people to get organized and get going here, which is going to be great. So I didn't quite know what to do today because there's so many stories. There's so many things in the news to cover that it just, you know, coming up with a title was kind of crazy. But anyway, I wrote this last night, you know, the thought here, didn't the government used to go after you for taking dangerous drugs? And it didn't occur to me until this morning how significant that was. So there was a time, not that long ago, when the government, I think it started the Nixon administration, and this new organization called the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, they were going to get illegal drugs off the streets. And we know how successful that was in the 80s with the whole, you know, cocaine thing. And of course, now we have fentanyl and all these other horribly dangerous drugs, opioids. The death rate from overdose, I think way exceeds what it is for COVID, which is never was, you know, as big a problem as everybody led you to believe. But the point of this was that the government had huge, you know, multi-billion-dollar programs. The DEA had its own Air Force practically. And if you ever see the movies, there was one with Tom Cruise playing, one of the pilots. He used to fly drugs in and out and guns in and out, part of the Contra operation, the whole bit. It's a great story. But anyway, the whole MENA Arkansas thing. And so that's what the government used to do. And then I think somewhere along the way, they decided that, they can't stop the drug business, so they might as well get it. All right. And this is exactly what's going on now. So you look at Big Pharma, you look at the FDA, the NIH, Dr. Fascist organization there, NIAID, the CDC, all these folks. They're basically government bureaucracies that are creating a situation where experimental dangerous vaccines have free reign. And so the government's not only aiding the pushing of these dangerous drugs, it has blocked the safe ones, you know, hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin. Apparently I was watching One American News last night. There's a whole series of new drugs that really are effective at stopping COVID cold. And of course the FDA doesn't want them because they're in the vaccine, you know, promotion business. That's their job apparently right now. And so this is this wild situation where the government's actually mandate that you take these experimentally, you know, dangerous drugs. And it didn't used to be that way. The government was on the other side of the issue. They used to actually stop dangerous drugs from coming into the country and from people from using them. And it reminds me, I'm curious what Jean thinks of this. So I'm going to bring her in just a little bit. It reminds me of the time not that long ago. And this would be back in the 50s, 60s, you know, a bit before my time, when there was something called the numbers game, and the mafia used to run it. And it's all over the East, the Northeast, I think Chicago, you know, so like you just couldn't draw a line from Chicago to Boston and then down to, Washington, you know, the Boston-Washington corridor and across to Chicago. You know, this is sort of like the mafia belt, and of course Vegas too. They used to have something called the numbers game. And the numbers game is where you picked numbers, if you pick the right numbers, you win. Gene, does that sound familiar to anything that's going on today? You know, you go to a reputable shop, usually a gas station or a market or a 7-Eleven, and you can go pay a dollar or two, and you can pick numbers, and you know, you can win a lot of money. You know what I'm talking
right.
about?
Yeah.
It's lottery. And so the government, whatever they can't stop, you know, they get in the business of, or they tax it. Look at alcohol, you know, prohibition, same thing. Yeah, and they start prohibition with the best of intentions, you know, supposedly. You know, we're gonna drive this nation. We're gonna make America sober. It's gonna be a wonderful, happy place. Well, it's a miserable place, you know, because organized crime skyrocketed. So what did the government do? Legalized alcohol and then taxed the hell out of it. You know, it's fascinating. The exception to this is cigarettes, because they, you know, no, there's nothing good comes from cigarettes. Even so, I wouldn't make them illegal, but I would certainly make them, you know, well, I don't know what to do with cigarettes. I'm just glad they're not out there. I wouldn't have any smoking in public because it's offensive to everybody. It's dangerous. And, you know, I there may be some into the whole second smoke thing. But the point is, that's the one thing that the government, as far as I know, didn't do. They didn't take over the tobacco industry and kind of force cigarettes on everybody as a mandate, which would be kind of stupid. But of course, I think they're promoting cigarettes all over China, Asia, you know, in different countries in Asia and around the world. I think so. The tobacco companies have sort of moved out of the United States to Europe and Asia, and that's, I think, probably Africa too. That's where they're selling all the product now. But it's interesting that the government, the whole point of this is that the government, what the government can't stop, they regulate, you know, and then they promote, and then they mandate. So you look at the progression of illegal drugs in particular, they couldn't stop them. You know, the border didn't work, and there's just too much money in it and too many people being paid off. So they tried to regulate. I mean, how do you regulate cocaine? You know, it's just kind of a crazy thing to do that. And so now, and they didn't want to actually, you know, promote those businesses, but they've sort of, you know, joined up with Big Pharma and this whole vaccine thing. You know, and they're making money. The government's making untold billions of dollars. The pharmaceutical mafia, you know, Big Pharma, which is now government sanctioned, is making billions of dollars, actually trillions, I think. Let me have the latest report on that. I know I had one of the many reports I've had this week that I haven't been able to get to just because we've been chatting away. And I'm going to get with Gene's opinion in just a minute here. But here's something from The Defender. Oh, by the way, The Defender is looking for writers, researchers, things like that. This is Robert Francis Kennedy's organization, Child's Defense, or Children's Defense Network. And so what they do, let me just make sure I get my title right here. I'll find it here somewhere. Anyway, so they published something called The Defender. And they wrote an article here, and this is by John Quealy, Q-U-E-A-L-L-Y. This is from Tuesday the 19th. Pandemic created 130 new billionaires, $2.1 trillion in new wealth, while millions suffered. Okay. News analysts by Americans for Tax Fairness, I'm not sure who they are, Institute for Policy Studies show in total 745 billionaires now hold $5 trillion in collective wealth, which is two-thirds more than the $3 trillion in wealth held by the bottom 50% of all U.S. households. You want me to do that one again? 745 billionaires. I'm not against billionaires. I don't, you know, but if you're making billions off Big Pharma, off the misery of people because the government's mandated something that they're calling a vaccine, which is a send your RNA protein spike, you know, COVID factory in your body. Yeah, I got a problem. Anyway, 745 billionaires hold $5 trillion in collective wealth, two-thirds more than the $3 trillion wealth held by 50% of U.S. households. And $5 trillion is it's more than the government takes in revenue every year. I think it was heading for $5 trillion, but of course, once they locked themselves down stupidly, they had a huge cut. I think it's like, you know, $3.5 to $4 trillion coming in, and yet they want to spend $5 trillion on infrastructure on one bill. Anyway, it says American billionaires grew in number and expanded their collective fortunes by $2.1 trillion since COVID-19 sparked a worldwide pandemic 19 months ago, according to a new analysis unveiled Monday. Gene, what do you think? You think $2.1 trillion? Do you think that's a little financial incentive to get into the mandatory vaccine business?
Oh, I definitely think so. Yeah.
You see where the
wow.
problem is? What do you think? What about the idea that what the government can't stop, they regulate. What they can't regulate, they take over. I mean, a lot of the government
They always find a way, you know, to make money.
Yeah. So government's not supposed to make money.
But it's very sad in that case because, the bottom line is there's so much, individual liberties and everything that we're given away by allowing this to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a crazy thing. And, you know, and I just had this realization beforehand that there's so many things the government has, you know, like I say, tried to stop, but they can't stop. They regulate, and then they end up in the business of. And so who makes money from the lottery? You know, the money, you pay the money to the stores, pays to the government. Government pays a certain amount back, but they say some goes to schools. But I don't know where the money goes. You know, maybe we should do a little lottery check sometime. Or actually, if you can do that right now, it'd be interesting. You know, if you find an article, you know, where does the money go? Where does the lottery money go? We know where big pharma money goes. We know where vaccine money goes. It goes to all the people that hold the patents and the royalties and the licensing rights, which is, you know, all the government bureaucrats, the government health bureaucrats. Dr. Fascist is, I'm sure, a multi-billionaire. If he wasn't before COVID, he is now. You know, with all the money he's making because of the patents and the license fees and the royalties that he owns. I mean, you want to audit somebody? You know, while the IRS is going after everybody that has more than $600 in transactions, which for most people over the course of 2 weeks is more than their paycheck. Okay, and if not, you got a problem. So what the government is saying is that every transaction over your first paycheck, you know, after January 1st, we're gonna start watching you because it's over $600. You know, you get paid twice a month. That first paycheck is going to be over $600.
Right, yeah.
If not, the second one will be. You know, $600 a month is, what's that, or a year? That's 6,000? No, you can't. That's below. No, it's be even $1,200 a month. You know, so by the end of your first paycheck, you're going to be over the threshold when the IRS can investigate you. So basically, anybody that gets a paycheck is going to have their account raided by the government. I mean, this is, like I said, really scary stuff. Do you want to look for lottery money, or do you have a computer?
I'm just doing that now.
Okay. Well, let me continue.
Because there's a lot of writing. Yeah, it doesn't just come to the lottery money goes to. It says it goes to paying out the cash, and then we're...
This, like, the lottery bureaucracy.
Typically lotteries raise funds for sports, development, education. I think a lot of them go to education.
Right.
Some states, that's how they pay for their citizens to go to college at a certain age, or like to the community colleges, that type of stuff. It also goes to social incentives, healthcare, and the development of underprivileged communities.
Oh, so it's welfare. Wait a minute, development of underprivileged communities. Do you think that
it doesn't say what? Let me see if I can find another article.
I'm just wondering do the words political payout come to mind? Do the words, you know, keeping minorities on the Democrat plantation with lottery money come to mind? Maybe we might have hidden something here. It's kind of interesting. See, I wasn't planning this. This is a fun
show.
We never know
what we're going to get. Yeah, it goes to public education. It says in many states the money goes to public education. That's what I would have thought, because a lot of times, especially when the lottery first started, they were talking about, you know, they'd always say, buy a lottery ticket. It helps for education.
Wow. Yeah.
Senior centers. Oh. Sorry, that was talking about lottery, and someone is going to talking about getting his old life back.
Well, and this is the funny thing about lottery rooms, is they don't keep the money very long.
Yeah, unfortunately. It's very sad.
That's crazy. Yeah. All right. Let me continue on this a little bit, and then I have, of course, a ton more articles. But yeah, it's just interesting here, American billionaires, and where's the government on taxing the rich? I mean, that's what the funny thing is that, you know, the Democrats are in on this, and they're making money too. I'm sure they're being paid off, because it used to be tax the rich. And where's Occupy Wall Street? And where's the 99%? And where are the tents in the cities? How come the tents out outside the FDA, and the CDC, and the NIH? You know, because they're making all the money. And where's the protests in front of Big Pharma? You know, Democrats didn't used to like Big Pharma. And now they're being paid off by Big Pharma. Now they're friends. It's quite fascinating. Anyway, it says an overall 70% surge of wealth among the nation's richest individuals since March of 2020 has resulted in approximately 130 new billionaires. That's B for folks. That's B for Bravo. You know, found the new report released by Americans for Tax Fairness, ATF. It's a rather unfortunate acronym. And the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS. You know, that's close enough to IRS, folks. In a statement, the groups noted that there are now 745 people with 10-figure bank accounts, compared to the 614 that existed when the pandemic first hit. 10 figures. Let me see. 7 figures is a million. So 8 would be 10 million. 9 would, that's over a billion. Yeah, that's that. Why would you have $1 billion in the bank? What kind of idiot does that? Well, I mean, you could live off the interest alone. The interest would be, you know, interest of $1 billion would be, what's 10% of a billion? 100 million. Yeah, there's $100 million a year in interest at 10%. Wow. In total, those 745 billionaires now hold $5 trillion in collective wealth, which the group's note is two-thirds more than the $3 trillion in wealth held by the bottom 50%. You know, those are the figures they had before. According to these two groups, the great good fortune of these billionaires over the last 19 months is all the more stark when contrasted with the devastating impact the coronavirus had on working people. Almost 89 million Americans have lost their jobs. Okay, over 44.9 million have been sickened by the virus, and over 724,000 have died from it. Well, I'm going to dispute that because we're not really sure. You know, according to John Cullen, most of this is the Spanish flu that's been resurrected. And the fact that the people that died, you know, with COVID as opposed to died from it is only about 5 or 6%. So of 724,000, you know, calculator, yeah. Hate it when I can't find my calculator. All right, so let's get the latest count here. So 745,000 times 0.05%. That's 37,000 people. So you're talking about a mandate, an upheaval of society, you know, costing 89 million people their jobs, you know, for 37,000 people who've died. You want to call that, you think it's a little misplaced the priority here? Anyway, so it's just, it's an amazing amount of money that has changed hands. So it's not that the economy is bad. The economy is great. The problem is where the money is going and where it's not going. Whereas it used to go to Americans with, you know, new jobs, you know, and new factories, and the wealth was actually, you know, gotten by those who earned it. Now the wealth, you know, this is the problem of a centrally planned economy. Now the wealth goes to the places it's channeled, big pharma, because they've mandated something that should never have been mandated, you know, and you're creating billionaires. You're moving trillions of dollars of wealth out of the productive economy into big pharma by these vaccine mandates. And then of course, you know, the 80 million people have lost their jobs, and that doesn't count all the folks who have, you know, and it's reported that up to 45,000 have already died of this. There was an affidavit done by Jane Doe, a whistleblower, and if 45,000 people plus have died of the vaccine, and 37,000 have actually died, you know, from COVID and nothing else, then the vaccine count has exceeded the COVID count by quite a lot, you know, by difference of 37,000 to 45,000. Anybody wants to do some quick math? I'm guessing that's about 25% more already, and that figure is several months old. So we don't really know. Here's another one, Defender. Defender has some great articles. 81 research studies confirm natural immunity to COVID equal or superior to vaccine immunity. Okay? This is another thing they don't want you to know. They being, you know, big pharma, big government, or big government pharma. They can probably lump them together. The article is by Paul Elias Alexander, PhD. So this is no dummy. Again, from Tuesday. We should not force COVID vaccines on anyone when the evidence shows that naturally acquired immunity, in other words, you get COVID and get over it, all right, is equal to or more robust and superior to existing vaccines. Instead, we should respect the right of the bodily integrity of individuals who decide for themselves. Public health officials and the medical establishment, with the help of the politicized media, are misleading the public with assertions that the COVID-19 shots provide greater protection than natural immunity. Okay, so it's plain and simple. And I can't put this on Facebook. I'll tell you right now, I can't put this on Facebook because they're immediately going to scream and yell and say fake news, censorship, because it goes against their narrative. Okay, so who are the criminals? You know, the criminals are big tech for censoring the information, the FDA for criminalizing the cures, you know, big pharma for you know, getting a protected marketplace where they're getting trillions of dollars. So, the crime goes all over the place. And the best thing you can do is resist. And so more and more folks are going to resist. I'm going to talk about that with Cindy again, who was on last week, who did such a nice job on her first guest appearance. And I said, why don't you come on every week? Let's chat more. So we're going to find out about Citizens for Medical Freedom. And then we have Jane Adams, who's going to join us on Fridays now. So her reports, it was now. She's switched over to Fridays. So a lot of schedule changes, a lot of things. I'll put it I'll post on the Action Radio group. I'll put the new schedule. But things are kind of moving around here. It's every day is different, and every day is different from what it used to be, you know, 3 weeks ago. So it's a fascinating, very dynamic show here. It's never the same week to week. All right. Okay. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CT, which I call the Center for Direct Control, Director Rochelle Walensky, for example, was deceptive in her October 2020 publicized Lancet statement that, quote, there is no evidence for lasting protective immunity to SARS-CoV-2 following natural infection. Okay, now think about that. The head of the CDC, someone who supposedly knows something about diseases, said that there's no evidence for lasting immunity following a natural infection. I don't know about you, and I'm going to ask Jean about this when she gets a chance to answer, but have you ever heard of any viral infection where your body doesn't have lasting immunity from getting it? If you get a cold, you never get that cold again. And of course, the rhinovirus, the cold virus, coronavirus, by the way, changes so rapidly. It's mutating, you know, hourly. So, you know, you're never getting the same cold twice. But the thing is, the idea that your immune system would not have lasting protection from a viral infection, it won't have the memory of it. It's true for every other virus. Why is this one different? Unless, of course, they're just lying to us. Gene, do you know any virus that your natural immunity does not get stronger once it gets over the virus, once it cures it in your body? Have you ever heard of that?
No, I can't think of any.
Yeah. So she's lying. We knew she was lying. I just want to know why she's lying or you know, the extent of it. She says that, and this is the CDC director again, the consequence
of
warning.
Well, and they get by with it.
Go ahead. Yeah, well, that's true. And nobody corrects them because, you know, the media are watchdogs, the people. And there's another, well, here's another thing too, the media. You know, at what point did the media become, you know, a government propaganda arm? And when did they stop being, you know, the investigative arm? Do you remember 60 Minutes? I'll give you the perfect example. Mike Wallace versus Chris Wallace. Mike Wallace, who actually spoke at my graduation at the University of Massachusetts. Mike Wallace, you know, for 60 Minutes was a great investigator. You know, he was tough. He'd show up in companies and he'd set the cameras and say, we're here. You know, and if you didn't want to interview with them, you know, he'd say, well, so-and-so refused an interview. Of course, that makes them look bad. If they do interview,
right.
he asked tough questions, which made them look bad. So either way, they look bad. You know, it's like it was a big joke. You don't want to see Mike Wallace show up in your office with cameras. You know, it's all over. You've got a problem. But nowadays, 60 Minutes, I haven't heard of them break a story probably 20 years. You know, Chris Wallace is the Democrat shill now. His weekend press show is like it's like the Biden propaganda cheerleader report.
Yeah. But the thing is, with that, I think they turn more, I don't want to say celebrity, but they're more into getting the big stories from non-news related things, if that makes sense. It's like other, you know, celebrities and people that are thought of as being, how would you say, upper class, whatever. Anytime there's a story, they want to get those instead of, you know, getting the meat and potato stories that they used to get years ago. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, interesting. I'm just going to finish this quote here. And then I got like six articles from The Defender and other things. This is the report I was going to – I normally give on Wednesdays, but we're just – like I say, we're busy around here, and I'm anticipating Cindy calling us in a little bit too. Center for Disease – whatever it is, just the consequence of waning immunity will present a risk to vulnerable populations in the imminent future. Now, this directly contradicts what we heard from The Defender – it's National News. National News says there's a 5% decline in you know, whatever immunity there is from the COVID shots, you know, each week. 5% decline, you know, so this is why they have second shots and booster shots and, you know, because all of a sudden if people are not getting their sort of re-injection, you know, of this alleged vaccine, which is really a messenger RNA, you know, COVID factory maker in your body, it's not working. And natural immunity, you know, there's no reports of it getting worse than 99%, you know. So your natural immunity is 99%+. It's almost 100% if you're under 18. When I say almost, I mean they can't measure the difference. It's 99.999, I don't know how many nines, you know, but it goes a long way. And so the under 18 crowd is statistically 100% immune because the difference is so slight it doesn't matter. The over 18 to like 30 group, is 99.997%, whatever. It's ridiculously high. And it doesn't get to above 85 where you start really getting, you know, below the 99%. It's like 95% at that point. But it's still ridiculously high. And so with cures and treatments, this would not be an issue. It is an issue because all roads lead to vaccines. Anyway, here's another quote. Immunology and virology, something that Dr. Fascius has no degree in, by the way. Dr. Fascius is not a virologist or an immunologist or an immunologist or an epidemiologist. He has no medical training that I can find beyond his basic medical degree from Cornell University. Go ahead, look it up. Let's see if Bumperjack wants to look it up. Oh, Skype line's open too. So we have our worldwide Skype line. We've got our live chat line. You just go to the broadcast page if you're listening live, and then you'll be able to find what's going on. And, of course, without Bumperjack, where would we be? You know, we need to have someone to let us know, you know, what the other half is thinking and how they're misinformed so that we can correct it. All right. Here we go. There's even strong evidence for the presence of antibodies. Even the CDC recognizes natural immunity for chickenpox and measles, mumps and rubella, but not for COVID-19. So in other words, they're lying. Let's see what my next article is here. We've got many. Here we go. Now, this is something kind of interesting. It says unconscionable. Pfizer, Moderna to rake in combined $93 billion in 2022 COVID vaccine sales. Okay, we already reported on that. Here's something I find interesting that you don't hear about Moderna as much as you used to, that apparently for some reason that I don't know yet, they have fallen out of favor. Moderna was the golden child of vaccines. You know, it was the new company. It was, they got the government grants. They got the contracts. You know, Warp Speed, the company that you heard about all through Warp Speed was Moderna. Now, Pfizer's the vaccine of choice. Whenever they talk about mandates and things like that, government's pushing Pfizer. So the next question is, you know, is Pfizer outspending Moderna in government lobbying fees, you know, or contributions to Big Pharma? Are they paying more for their vaccine, you know, in terms of licensing and royalties than Moderna did? Because they're a bigger company.
I wouldn't doubt it.
You know, have you noticed the change, though?
Yeah, but I did read an article, I didn't read it, I just looked at the heading, and it's crazy, now you can, they're talking you can definitely mix the vaccine.
Well,
which I would say, heck no, because they're totally different, each one of them.
And why would they do that? Just to push more vaccines? I mean, they have such reckless disregard for life.
Yes. Well,
they don't care.
Also think about it. Johnson & Johnson just has the one. Why would they just want people just to get one?
Well, didn't Dr. Fascius come out recently and say that that Johnson & Johnson should actually make that two shots? Seems to me I remember him saying that within the last like week or so.
That could be.
We can look it up.
But that don't surprise me either.
Oh, no. And, so where's Johnson & Johnson? They were never the golden child of vaccines. They were always like the evil stepsister. You know, it's like because they only had one. I think you're absolutely right. I think it's because they had one that, Dr. Fascius. Yeah, here's a question for you. I don't know if you'd be able to find this. If there's any record, probably in the foreign press. See if Dr. Fascius has any record of offshore accounts, any record of money anywhere internationally. See if there's any report of report of a Swiss bank account, a Cayman Islands account, and then they won't know how much because these are all secret accounts. But if any investigative reporter in the world, obviously the American reporter's not doing it, but I'd be curious if anybody in the world has found any extra money from Dr. Fascius. For those that don't know, that's Dr. Anthony Fauci. We call him Dr. Fascius, a genocidal psychopathic vaccine drug pusher for a reason, because he's a genocidal psychopathic vaccine drug pusher. All right, so here's an article in The Defender again. This is from Megan Renshaw. And this, they're looking for reporters, by the way. So if you're looking for a job, you want to work for a fabulous organization until you get your job with Action Radio, you go to The Defender, Children's Health Defense. It says here, the Pfizer and Moderna COVID vaccines are both linked to heart inflammation. That's myocarditis. In May, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration authorized Pfizer's vaccine for 12 to 17-year-olds, but the agency is delaying its decision on authorizing Moderna's vaccine for adolescents while it assesses whether the shot could increase the risk of myocarditis. So you want to talk about favoritism? So how much more did Pfizer pay so they could destroy the hearts of teenagers for life than Moderna paid so they could destroy the hearts of teenagers for life? that's the question. All right. So
I got something here. It doesn't say about offshore accounts, but here it says this is according to I don't even know what. Let's see what is it. real raw news that Dr. Fast just had a lucrative 2020 netting $9 million in miscellaneous income. There
miscellaneous?
You go. Miscellaneous income.
They're calling it miscellaneous income?
Yep.
Nine million?
Yep.
What's the source? This is great.
Well, it says Real Raw News.
Okay. Send me the link on that. $9 million. That's hysterical. Oh, I love it. Yeah, Dr. Fascist. Yeah, you're making money. We know he's making money. So we need to, you know, it'd be interesting if he ever turned up in the America's, you know, newest billionaires.
And supposedly it was on the 2020 tax return.
Interesting. And so he has, what's the name of the source of the raw news?
Real Raw News, Thursday, Real? October 21st.
That's today.
Hold on. No, let me see. Oh, no, this is April 12th. That'll look
okay.
Like Keith Richards.
What, the rock star for the Rolling Stones?
I don't think so, but...
I'm teasing you.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Let's bring Cindy into the conversation.
Look on ChatTube Upper Deck has a lot of prestigious things on Dr. Fascist, but we already know that don't mean anything because, you know, people can do a lot
of
good,
yesterday.
Supposedly good things, but all you have to do is look at the debacle he did with AIDS and how what he said they should do, how that killed many of people.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Dr. Mikovits has a whole history of that. Cindy, good morning. Cindy Cagle,
yeah.
Let's bring you in the conversation here. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm good. How about you?
I am well. I'm very well. So Cindy's going to do our Citizens for Medical Freedom report. And so Cindy was such a superstar last week that I asked her to come on regularly. And so it gives us a chance, Gina and I, to kind of hash things over a little bit beforehand. This is a busy day because we got Bill Fecky, who normally has he used to have the 7 o'clock slot on Thursdays when we started the show at 7. He'll be back today for a special appearance. And then we've got Jonathan Mosley at 7:30. This is Central Time, by the way, for those that are listening. And then at 8 o'clock, we've got... 8:15, Claire Lopez. This is a busy, busy day. So what do you think of the idea that, Cindy, that Dr. Fascist, who we affectionately call Dr. Fauci around here, Dr. Fascist has $9 million extra bucks in his pocket, you know, above the $450,000 government salary. Okay, so this just came out. So, yeah, send it to me. I'll post it on my Facebook page. But that's what we're dealing with. So I don't know if your organization wants to look into that. I think that'd be something fascinating to kind of publish, that we need to out this guy. You know, let's see if he shows up in America's Newest Billionaires or any of those other publications, because they tend to do that kind of stuff. But so Real Raw News. Real Raw News, right, Gene? You know, she thinks she's busy doing stuff. Gene, don't worry about it. Real Raw News. I'm going to look it up. I'm going to be playing our Santa Rosa. I don't know when I'm going to do that, too. Oh, that's going to be interesting. What am I going to fit that in? I still got to play our Santa Rosa report. I mean, the things get busy right here on Thursday. So it's going to be crazy. So, Cindy, what you been working on the last week or so? What's going on? What's new in medical freedom?
Well, there is lots going on.
Okay.
You know, with the new vaccine for children, that seems to be a focus for our government to get them vaccinated. And, of course, that's ridiculous because children are at, I believe they said it was a 0.01% chance of being, hurt by COVID.
What's less than that? It's like 0.01. It's like 99.999%.
Yeah.
Statistically, there is no difference. It's as close to zero as you can get without actually being there, because they can't say that for sure, because there are some kids that are affected by this, but they don't know whether it's the comorbidities,
sure,
other problems. And, of course, stuff happens. I mean, people have genetics. I mean, people die from diseases. You know, one person out of a million might die from something simply because they have a genetic predisposition to not have enough immunity, natural immunity, and that's going to happen. But that happens, you know, for all the viruses I know. There's always somebody that for whatever reason, has a vulnerability to it. I mean, why are people born with, you know, bad kidneys? I mean, kidney transplants. I was just watching they transplanted a pig kidney. That's scary. You know, they're using sheep heart valves. So so basically we're getting animal parts now. So there's some really weird things going on in medicine. That might be something to look into also, transplants. That might be a whole new branch for you. Anyway, go ahead. Yeah. What were you going to say?
I was going to say one doctor listening to said that just as many kids die of the flu as have died from COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's true, why aren't people, why don't they do something about the flu? But no, they sap a whole, well, they sap the whole world basically for the COVID. But it's crazy. And especially with kids, it's like, yeah, it's very sad when any child or any person dies. However, when you put it into perspective, look how many people die of the flu and there's no outrage.
Well, it's twice as many as died from COVID. Flu is like 85,000 people a year. COVID, we figured, was those that died actually from COVID at about, 5 to 6% of the 724,000 that was reported, by CDC. That's around 37,000 people. And yet the affidavit from Jane Doe, as I just talked about earlier, Cindy, before you got here, says that she thinks up to 45,000 people have already died of this.
Mm.
The COVID vaccine count by affidavit, by whistleblower, is already exceeding the COVID death count of those that actually died from, not with, but from COVID with nothing else, which is a very small number. 37,000 is less than half the annual flu deaths. And kids especially, here's a thought for you, Cindy. Tell me what you think of this, that they can't go now and suddenly start treating the flu as COVID. They almost had to come up with a new virus, because flu, we've been going to school with flu, work with flu. We stay home for a few days, we recover, we have a fever, you feel miserable, maybe you're, throwing up, you're doing whatever the flu viruses do. And I had norovirus, which is even worse than flu. It's like the worst, viruses I've ever had. That's the cruise ship when they don't quite do things properly. But 3 days of misery and I'm fine. I mean, we get sick. That's what happens. We're in the natural world, but I never got it again. But is there, do you think that because we've never masked up for flu, I mean, the flu shot's out there, but we've never held up society for it. We've never stopped kids from going to school. We've never done anything, that it'd be a bit late now to try and do it? Or do you think
Absolutely.
They just wanted a new virus? Okay. All right. Yeah.
Absolutely. And why we would then push a vaccine that we don't know the long-term effects of, on our children, just defies logic. It's scary, and it's not necessary. But that seems to be the focus now of our government, is to get our kids vaccinated with this unknown long-term side effect vaccine.
I would also, if I could offer a suggestion, I would stop using the word vaccinated, because it feeds in the propaganda. I actually did a press release yesterday, which will be sent to all the folks on our list, of like new language of correct terms. You'll never hear me see Biden administration, because he's not a legal president. He's still under an ongoing investigation of election audits. It's the insurrection. It's the thief in chief. It's President Nobody. It's something like that. I'll put you on the press release list. It's kind of cool, the whole new vocabulary. But you notice how you use terms like Dr. Fascist and all these different things. And I call it the Biden surrender in Afghanistan. It wasn't withdrawal. Mm. A withdrawal is when you go out legally and everything's fine. A surrender is when you give up all your weapons, you leave Americans behind, and you bring in 100,000, goat herders and their 5-year-old wives. I put it in those stark terms because I want people to be shocked by it, because it's a shocking thing that happened. So in the same way, we're not vaccinating children, because that implies that this is a good thing. It implies that it's psychological. The psychology of the language that you use makes a huge difference. When I say Dr. Fascist, do you think of him as a good guy?
No, we shouldn't.
Visions of genocidal psychopathic drug pressure. So in the same way, so what would you say, other than vaccinated? I call it, spike protein infused, vaccine injured, DNA altered. There's like a million terms we can use. And, I leave it to your creativity. But something, if you really want to help, I think, the cause of medical freedom, and I want to help you, do that. My experience with politics and with language, and the Republicans are notoriously bad at this. This is what I call the gelding old party. Okay, GOP, the geldings. Okay, so when you think of the gelding old party, does that imply competence and bravery? Does that imply a wild stallion running free? Or does it imply a draft horse hauling a bunch of crap in a wagon? So you see how these words have power?
I do. I will work on that. But in all honesty, our movement tries to come from a position of choice and personal freedom. And while I may, not agree with it and think it's, something that you don't need, I know there is a part of society that might benefit from it or feels they benefit from it and need it. So I do try and come into it from both sides.
Okay.
You know, whether that
can
helps our
that?
Movement or.
But I think
you know,
that's good. Let each person make their own decision.
Yeah.
Telling them what to do. You can give them information to help them make that decision. But even like with kids, okay, that's the CDC, whoever's recommending, all these people are recommending the kids get it, but the people that are recommending it, who trusts them? They have no ounce of credibility left in them.
And that's our job, is to give them the other side. They're able to silence, you know, the side of science that we're listening to and brings us to the conclusion that it is, you know, potentially poisonous or not needed. My goal is to give that perspective and allow them to make a decision that we've been able to make because we're listening to, you know, different doctors.
So it almost sounds like you're too impartial. I'm not picking on you. But,
no, I think they have to be, though. I think
you
really
do? Okay.
Lay out the facts and let people – that's all you have to do. Tell the truth, and people will come up with their own decision. Instead of – I think sometimes if you go more one way or the other way, you're going to lose people just because they say, oh, you're anti-this,
yeah.
You're pro-this.
Yeah.
No, if you
just
lay out the facts. I think that way, and let people think that they're making their own decision. I think that's the best way to do it. Because if someone tells me not to do something or to do it, whatever, it's like, does that mean I'm going to follow what they say? Sometimes you do the opposite just because you don't want someone to tell you what to do.
I think I'm guilty of that. Look at Action Radio. Sorry, Greg, you can't follow your format. It's okay. Well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start my own show. So there. You know.
Well,
that's
consider
a valid point.
The...
Yeah.
The number of people that have gotten the vaccine,
mm-hmm.
You know, that puts them in a very difficult position. So I do try to inform them and let them know why we're coming to the decision we're coming to. But ultimately, it's a personal decision. And I think a lot of people are making the decision differently than I would because the information they're getting is different.
See, that's the problem. See, this is, I think, where my advocate side comes out. I agree that everybody has a personal decision. You know, when it comes to our bills, I don't tell people what to say or what to comment on, you know, but we try and get the best information and be as open as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're facing a situation where the government is actually propagandizing and big tech is censoring, you know, and big pharma is making, trillions of dollars off this now.
Mm.
I mean, it's a ridiculous amount of money. That changes people. That changes, you know, their ethics. You know, there are government scientists and there are private scientists. There are government doctors and there are private doctors. And they're saying very different things. The government doctors have a very pro-government big pharma agenda. That's not an accident. So as much as I want to be, I can't be impartial, you know, and I don't make any claims. I'm not a journalist. I'm an advocate. You know, this show is about citizen legislation. It's not about, you know, giving both sides. I don't want to give, you know, there's enough both sides. Well, Rush Limbaugh used to say, you know, I am, you know, fairness. I am the other side or whatever, you know. And this is the same thing. We need to give out the information that's not being heard. And I'm not going to do that impartially.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So,
and
when someone is making money off of something they're pushing, you got to question that. Because right there's an ulterior motive. Anytime when someone gets a kickback, gets some financial means, how can you tell or trust what they're saying is actually true? Or are they just saying it because for the financial kickback? And that is huge for some people. I mean, for a lot of people, especially now, if you consider COVID times where people lost their jobs, people weren't working last year, and just, you know, wanting to get ahead or be like their neighbor or whoever, whatever, you don't know, but... Yeah, how can you have to look at that too? If there's any financial gains they're getting, you can't say that they're impartial.
Yeah, Cindy, what were you going to say? That's interesting. Yeah.
I lost that thought, but no, I'm certainly
teasing.
I know the decision that's right for me and my family, and while it may be different for my neighbor or you know, the government. I don't pretend to agree or advocate for the people that are making a different decision. I'm certainly approaching this from the side that helped me come to the decision for me and my family. But I don't take away from the fact that this is a free country, and if that's the decision that they make for themselves and it's different than mine, so be it. They live with the consequences of that decision. I just want, and our movement stands for the right to make a different decision. And the information that helped me come to that decision is being silenced. And that's our goal, is to get that information out there so that the people that are making a different decision have the information that we're using and hopefully come to a different decision going forward.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree with what you're doing. My problem is that there's so much bad information that's countering what you're saying that we really have to get the story out about that. But I absolutely agree in free choice. But free choice is dependent on free information, the free flow of information.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise there is no free choice. You know, it's a coerced choice. And I was just wondering, as you and Gene were talking, if someday vaccine injury is going to be a detriment to people that, you know, just like people, companies don't want smokers now. You know, are they not going to, are the insurance actuarial is going to come out and say, well, did you get, back in 2020, did you get the alleged COVID vaccine? Because, you know, and that would go into, or life insurance might someday, you know, think of this as a detriment, as a life-shortening event. You know, we don't know yet, but this is one of the big concerns
the
I have, that no one's talking about it. What's that,
Jean? You see all the lawsuits that would happen? And the reason I say that, because the government is pushing this vaccine, or that this jet, whatever you want to call it.
And they're not liable for lawsuits, by the way.
But they're pushing it. And so in the future, if, like, let's say life insurance companies say, oh, no, we can't cover you because you got it, that, I would think, is a huge lawsuit, because a lot of people look at the people that said that, or know they're going to lose their job if they don't get it. How many got it just so they wouldn't lose their job?
A lot.
How many are going to lose their job because they did get it,
years
from now?
That the people that didn't get it in the future, they're not going to possibly be affected if they can't get life insurance because it's a new point. They didn't get it. But if you say that in the future they're going to be, I don't want to say discriminated, but that's pretty much what it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because they got it, some people didn't get it because it was their first choice or their 10th choice. They got it because they didn't want to lose their job, or they needed to go travel somewhere because maybe whatever reason, they wanted to go see their family or a sick relative or a friend or someone somewhere else, and otherwise they wouldn't have been able to travel.
Interesting. I want to go back to Cindy for a second. You mentioned several times that your movement. Let's get folks caught up, how it got started, what you want to do with it, and where you want to go, what you see happening. And, of course, obviously how folks can contact you. But tell me about the movement. Tell me about medical freedom as a movement, because that's new. That's a whole new idea.
Well, you know, it started as a support group with Ascension Sacred Heart, them being kind of the at the forefront of these ridiculous mandates. They were out on the sidewalk, and, you know, community citizens that wanted to support them were standing with them.
Yeah, it was me. I was there, too. I was the first one.
So that's how this kind of started. And then as other sectors decided to follow their lead, you know, the community support has kind of moved in other directions. Certainly we support our medical or our healthcare workers, but now it's to kind of focus on any of these businesses doing this stuff and push back, inform, you know, the public, and let the employees know that are facing that we support them, and hopefully give them the courage to stand by, you know, the very difficult decisions they're having to make, you know, getting a vaccine to feed your family. Some of the stories, they're heartbreaking, and they're something I can't believe is happening in our country. So that's kind of how it started. The goal is, you know, ideally I would love to see the numbers that we see overseas on the sidewalk, because I truly believe, you know, peaceful, noncompliance is effective. And if we could show up in those kinds of numbers, I think a lot of these employers would reverse course and stop this because it isn't legal. There hasn't been any laws or the administration hasn't made this a law. It's merely words, recommendations, and all of these businesses know it. I've looked at their policies, their COVID policies, and you know they indicate that they are following guidance and recommendation. That in itself gives them the flexibility or the ability to say, we're not doing this. So why are they doing it?
Well, some companies aren't. There's like a split in this country. The In-N-Out Burger in particular in San Francisco said that they were not following San Francisco's policies.
Yeah.
So I think the thing to do is the companies that are not doing this need to be highlighted. You know, but they're out there. And you can find them. I think there are lists of companies. You can go online and find companies that are specifically hiring that do not, you know, have this mandate. And those are the companies that are going to succeed, because I still think that the people most likely to resist this messenger RNA, you know, gene therapy infusion are the leaders, are the independent people, are the people that work the hardest, you know, that are, well, not work the hardest, but at least they're the ones that have the ideas that will help their companies the most, that are going to come up and, you know, if something's going wrong, they're going to want to fix it. They're not just going to go along with blind loyalty. And so you're weeding out all the best people. You know, so I joked around with this, you know, a week ago, if this thing is as lethal as we think it is, you know, they're going to be, you know, killing the compliant and leaving the rebels like us. You know,
well, and that's what I say about our health care.
Tell me about the
mandate that they're implementing. It's pushing a lot of the experience. The people that have been doing this for years, you know, are close enough to say, I'm not getting the vaccine or the jab. I'm just going to leave. So then you're left with a healthcare system made up of, you know, inexperienced, overworked, understaffed healthcare. And who wants that as a society? Is that the type of medical care that we'll accept? It just defies logic, and it's certainly not a system that's going to maintain a standard that probably we all are used to. Well, I was just going to say, so, you know, as I was saying, it started as kind of a support for our healthcare, and it's morphed into really any of these companies following this stuff to push back and be on the sidewalk to let people know these companies are doing these things. Because I do think there is a lot of people that don't know some of these companies that are doing it. We look at healthcare because that's kind of where things started. But, you know, we've been at Navy Federal. Who knew that a bank and one of the largest employers in our area was doing some of this nonsense. So that's kind of been our focus, is to now bring attention to the businesses in our area that are doing things like that. Like I said, with the focus of kids now being the bullseye to be vaccinated, we just learned of a community health clinic that's incorporated some sort of Halloween event into a vaccination site for kids.
Well, that's disgusting.
It really is. It's going to be my goal to be out on the sidewalk with our movement to let people know that that's maybe not a decision they want to make, and that's not really what Halloween is about. But in the near future, this weekend, we're going to be in front of Navy Federal in Pensacola. We're going to be at a branch this time, and we're going to Tallahassee on Saturday to support parental rights and medical freedom rally with the Florida Freedom Keepers. So it's trying to build a movement that has numbers that make people stop and think, okay, I'm not alone, and help us push back.
Yeah. How about the rally so far? Anything come out of the Pensacola rally, which was absolutely fabulous? This is like a week ago Tuesday.
Well, you know, certainly we had a huge attendance for something that really was an overnight plan. Mm-hmm. Ended up being, I think the word was close to 3,000 people that showed up.
Oh, wow.
Of course, and I'll just let you know that there are plans in the works for another rally with the Panhandle Doctors. They're looking to have another event next month. So be on the lookout for that. They are actively working to get this month's rally on Rumble. I think also they're talking about being available on DVDs. So that's in the works. It's just the odds are the forces against them are tremendous, as you can imagine. But yeah, that's coming, and we're hoping that with a little more planning time, we will be able to increase those numbers. The goal is to actually pack the stadium, if that's the venue they're going to hold it at again. But for something that really kind of happened overnight, the attendance, I think, was very encouraging.
I think it grew during the event itself. I mean, you know, Everybody's like, they had their cell phones out. It's like, you got to come down. I think that thing was filling up until the end. So there was a snowball effect. But what that tells me is, first of all, the folks that were there, nobody was wearing a mask. Nobody cared. We're all sitting right next to each other. We know this is a bunch of nonsense. So you had the most independent, you know, people, probably the best informed in that audience. I mean, that was definitely the converted. So what we need to do is reach out beyond that. And I think that's what I'm hoping that the rallies and demonstrations do. And the companies themselves, they need to know that what they're doing isn't right. But look at Southwest, how quickly Southwest caved.
Yes.
Now, that's got to be inspiring to you.
It is, very. And that's the message I'm trying to convey through our movement, is that there is power in numbers. And we don't have to be burning things down. But if we show up in numbers, or we put enough pressure on these businesses, we can affect change.
Yeah. Burning things down would be the worst thing you can do.
Just getting them on the sidewalk.
Yeah, I mean, those people that think that the Black Lives Matter and Antifa people that think that burning and destroying is the way to win the hearts and minds of Americans, they are sadly mistaken. The only way to do it is persuasion. And you can be loud, you can have rallies, you can scream and yell in the streets, you can carry signs, you can do whatever you want. As long as you don't break things, you know, people don't care. As long as you don't hurt people, you know, then because that's what usually gets focused on is that. But this is wonderful. We only have a couple minutes left, and we'll pick this up again next week. I've got Bill starting. I want to play our San Rosa Volunteers piece before he gets here. But contact information, especially for the rallies, where, when, you know, give some information for the group that you can, and we'll see who's interested, and then maybe Panhandle Doctors for Freedom if they're publicly available, or if not, you know, I mean, we should know that too. But just to let people know, there are private groups, and the reason they're private is because they don't want to get fired. They don't want to get persecuted, prosecuted, victimized, outed, censored, doxed. You know, the list goes on. There are very good reasons for people to remain private. I want to respect that. But anything you can, you know, tell me about contact would be good, and especially information on the rallies. And I'll be posting it again too.
Okay, awesome. Cindy? Well, you can find us on Telegram if you're interested in our rally information. C, the number 4, MF, exclamation, rally info. That is a place to find out where we're going to be and when. Like I said, we're going to be at Navy Federal Credit Union across from Center for Sight on Friday. Please join us. We're going to Tallahassee on Saturday. Panhandle Doctors are working on a platform to communicate with the public, so more information about that will be coming. But please reach out to me. You can email me, c4mf@protonmail.com to join our mailing list for event information. We'd love to have you. We need those numbers.
Oh, yeah, I think as more people find out about this, it's going to be a bigger and bigger thing, but especially the rally here will help. The rally in Tallahassee will help. I'm not a big rally person because I like writing the legislation behind the scenes. So if you can introduce to your group, Panhandle Doctors for Freedom, all these folks, on the fact that we have a bill here at Action Radio, and I'll send it to you again if you need it, okay. That limits, that puts full product liability back on the vaccine manufacturers. You know, we have a bill. I have a bill that I wrote with Dr. Zelenko, and I want these doctors to start endorsing these if they can. You know, if they can put their name to it. If not, I understand. But I'm just saying, I want to give them the option. But we have a bill that reforms the FDA, that changes the emergency use authorization procedure so that the FDA cannot monopolize it. You know, it would have allowed President Trump to authorize hydroxychloroquine back in August of 2020 if it had passed Congress. You know, so I mean, there are things that we can do, but the future I see is citizen legislation. So not only do we advocate a particular position, we actually give the legislature the means to carry it out the easiest way possible by simply submitting our bill, accepting our bill, and then doing what they do, you know, in the committee hearings and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. That's up to them. And then we decide if we want to keep them at the next election cycle. But that's the kind of thing we need to start advocating, and I think that would make a huge, huge change.
Well, and speaking of legislation, I guess I should plug that Tuesday we're having a delegation meeting with Senator Brockson, Andrew Andrade, and J.R. Williamson Tuesday evening. And several of us from our movement are speaking to effect change in Tallahassee. Show up, support us.
Where and when?
Because
Tuesday, address
Tuesday,
and time.
5:30. What is that? It's at the Board of County Commissioners building in Milton, and I can give you an address. It is 6495 Caroline Street at 5:30. Like I said, several of us will be speaking out against the mandates, but certainly there is power in numbers. Come out, support the people that are speaking, and let our delegation know that we need to affect change, that this needs to be a priority to stop this stuff.
Sounds good. On that note, I have to let you go. We've got a very tight schedule today. It won't be the same next week. We'll have a few minutes extra we can go over. Cindy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Citizens for Medical Freedom. We'll do it again next week.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you.
All right. You take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Anti-Federalist No. 6 was written officially under the name Sentinel, which is a collaboration of writers. This one is pure genius, so much so that I hardly need to comment except to present the most brilliant passages. I encourage you to read the whole of Anti-Federalist No. 6, as it is quite short, and in that brevity lies its power. It was published January 16, 1788. It begins, "The evils of anarchy have been portrayed with all the imagery of language in the growing colors of eloquence. The affrighted mind is thence led to clasp the new Constitution as the instrument of deliverance, as the only avenue to safety and happiness. To avoid the possible and transitory evils of one extreme, it is seduced into the certain and permanent misery necessarily attendant on the other." This is a great summation of what the much longer-winded Alexander Hamilton and John Jay were trying to hide in obfuscating yet colorful language. But essentially, that's it. Adopt the Constitution as is, or it's all over. America will cease to exist as we know it. The author then posits, if it's all over, if we don't immediately embrace the Constitution, and we descend into decadence and anarchy, is that really the worst possible outcome? Continuing on, Sentinel says this, "If anarchy, therefore, were the inevitable consequence of rejecting the new Constitution, it would be infinitely better to incur it, for even then there would be at least the chance of good government rising out of the licentiousness. But to rush at once into despotism because there is a bare possibility of anarchy ensuing from the rejection, or from what is yet more visionary, the small delay that would be occasioned by a revision and correction of the proposed system of government is so superlatively weak, so fatally blind, that it is astonishing any person of common understanding should suffer such an imposition to have the least influence on his judgment. In more modern language, stop filling the people with BS propaganda and tell the truth, because your lies aren't working. Then Sentinel presents the most brilliant observation into the fawning over and acceptance of the opinions of so-called, quote, experts, simply because they have risen to preeminent status. And that status alone is all that is needed to justify their aims, goals, and opinions. This mistake is the basis for the entire acceptance of government response to COVID, where clearly the experts are doing everything wrong, but want you to believe it's right, even after hundreds of thousands of people have died needlessly. But it's okay because they are experts, and they know best. Sentinel continues, but when I view among such converts men otherwise preeminent, it raises a blush for the weakness of humanity that these, her brightest ornaments, should be so dim-sighted to what is self-evident to most men, that such imbecility of judgment should appear where so much perfection was looked for. This ought to teach us to depend more on our own judgment and the nature of the case than upon the opinions of the greatest and best of men who, from constitutional infirmities or particular situations, may sometimes view an object through a delusive medium, but the opinions of great men are more frequently the dictates of ambition or private interest. Could anything more true be said today? This paper is so good, so full of richness, so prophetic as to what is happening today, that I'm going to hold at this the first paragraph and pick it up again next week with more of this amazing analysis, not only of what might happen with the ratification of the Constitution, but what actually did. The anti-federalists, it appears, were right. So now, what should we do? The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The anti-federalist papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it.
On tight, Action Radio presents the Fetke Report.
Oh, now you're all awake.
Good. Good morning, Action Radio. Greg, I am hotter than when Al Gore says Earth was supposed to be right now.
How long did you work on that line? That's great. Yeah.
All right.
Now, so, those who don't know, the lovely and talented Bill Fecky. Go ahead.
So the last couple of weeks, all we've been hearing is the big uproar about the government wanting to spy on our bank accounts and anything over $600. Now there's they've heard us, and now they've changed it to $10,000.
Same problem, different amount.
same problem. So I'm going to use a quote right now, and I want to know if you remember this quote, because this quote means everything to why we are where we are today. And that is, if you have nothing to hide, it shouldn't matter. Do you remember where that quote originated?
I don't know what originated, but it's always disgusted to me because that's not the point of a free society. The free society is not about what you have to hide. It's what the government can prove. And the fact that you have a right to your privacy, You know, so I'm not sure where it probably came from, the drug days or you know, or was it the left?
It started during the Patriot Act by Republicans.
Oh.
When Bush decided to say we're going to illegal wiretap for the
right.
I mean, he used better words, but mm-hmm. it all started with the illegal wiretapping. Okay, that's where it started. And all these Republicans said, if you have nothing to hide, then you shouldn't care, as long as it's going to protect our safe. Then fast forward, you know, 15 years to the whole stop and frisk, in which President Trump did originally endorse until he, took it back, thank goodness. But he originally endorsed stop and frisk. And once again, if you have nothing to hide, it shouldn't matter, right? You know, so if you're paying your taxes and you're not trying to hide money, what difference does it make if the government looks at your bank account?
Yeah.
The hypocrisy.
Yeah, except the whole basis of our country, you know, you go back to the colonial days, when, you know, the whole basis of our Constitution, you look at the Bill of Rights, half of it is on the rights of the accused. You know, the whole idea of innocent until proven guilty, that you have the right to be secure in your person, home, papers, and effects from unreasonable searches and seizures. I mean, this whole idea is so blatantly unconstitutional, I can't tell you. The idea that started with globalist Republicans doesn't surprise me any more than it would surprise me from globalist Democrats. It's still this globalist idea that the government is all-powerful, the government can search anything they want, they can harass you indefinitely. And what is it? Was it Karl Marx? No, it was either Stalin or Lenin, who said, I'll find the crime. You know, there's so many laws out there, they can find a crime. And idea is not whether you have something to hide. The idea is what the government can prove, and can they prove it legitimately with a reasonable search and a reasonable seizure from due process with laws where you're treated as innocent until proven guilty. They didn't just make stuff up or plant evidence. You know, the idea that you have nothing to hide is insane, because that's your person, that's your life, that's your property. You know, and this whole idea disgusts me. And yet, intrinsically, people think, well, gee, I guess that's true. If you have nothing to hide, you know, what are you worried about it being searched? Well, the search itself is illegal. That's what. So it's not that we have something to hide. It's that we have something to. They have something to prove, and we have a right to our privacy.
Correct.
Yeah. Anyway, so tell me more about this, Republicans,
makes,
the gelding.
So it just makes me sick that, you know, because of what started with the Patriot Act, labeling someone as a terrorist, okay? Mm-hmm. We Republicans are the ones who decided, well, if they're labeled as a terrorist, we have the right to do illegal things, for the lack of better terms.
This is a really important point. If you're doing illegal things, they can do illegal things to stop you. So in other words, if you can be demonized, if you can be called a terrorist for showing up at a school board meeting, for example, if you can be a terrorist because you're a white person, you know, and therefore a white supremacist, if you can be a terrorist because you voted for Trump, if you can be a terrorist, a domestic terrorist, because you walked through the Capitol building on January 6th, you know, so this whole, if you have nothing to hide, goes out the window completely, because the question is, does the government have anything to hide? What are they doing? You know, where are they coming up with this stuff? Where, you know, they're the ones who are hiding behind the idea that you have something to hide, and that they're right and that you're wrong, that everything they do is virtuous, you know, and that's a problem.
Correct.
That's
the whole point I was getting towards, is that with the start of the Patriot Act, labeling people as terrorists gave the government unlimited powers to do whatever they wanted to and throw the Constitution out the book. And so now today...
I think the window.
You know, what did I say?
Sit out the book. I think you meant throw the book out the window. That's okay.
Sorry.
That was a great metaphor. I loved it.
I want to throw the window out the book.
Okay. That's good. Yeah, this is what happens when you take a break from being on the show. You start saying things like that, but that's okay.
Yeah.
I'm glad to have you back.
But it's the Republicans who have started this mess, and they've sat back, and all the Republican voters are like, yeah, let's get terrorists, never thinking that we would be the terrorists.
Yeah.
And this is the stupidity of American voters as a whole, voting on emotion instead of voting for the Constitution. And until that day comes when voters start voting for the Constitution and not for a political party, we are doomed.
Well, I don't think we're doomed. I think you're on the right track. But the thing is that this is the dirty little secret. The freedom really has to be imposed. The whole point of a republic is so that people don't vote away the freedoms of the rest of us. you know, 51% idiots can vote away 49% of us, you know, thinking folks that actually know what's going on. It doesn't take much of a majority in a democracy to remove all your rights. And so that's why they use emotions. And that's why the Democrats push as much democracy as possible. A republic is your safeguard. A constitution that limits government is your safeguard, but it has to be used, not interpreted, used. There's a big difference. The Supreme Court is there to use the Constitution to overturn unconstitutional policies and laws. It is not there to interpret the Constitution to impose their political agenda, and that is all the difference in the world. The federal government is there to stop terrorism, not what they particularly think of as terrorism, anybody that goes against their agenda. I mean, they could call anybody – I'm sure that somewhere they've labeled anti-vaxxers as domestic terrorists because they want to kill grandma. They want to shut this nation down. They want to, you know, where in actual fact, the damage from these vaccines is horrible. You know, we've talked about that over and over. We just had Cindy from Citizens for Medical Freedom talking about there's a movement. There's a movement out there of people that do not want to be dictated to. And do they have something to hide? Well, let's get into HIPAA. You're in the health professions. You know, we're talking about something to hide. Isn't your vaccine status something that you can legally hide using the colloquial we're talking about
okay.
here? It's somebody's
so,
business,
so
right?
So what people don't understand, and the other thing that irritates me is throwing this
okay.
HIPAA thing. All of a sudden, everyone's a legal expert on HIPAA. and they've never even – they don't even know what HIPAA stands for, which I'm not going to lie, I don't either. I know it's like health information something, yeah. But anyway, but what HIPAA is mm-hmm. that your doctor cannot disclose information to anybody else, but you yourself can. And
do you have to?
It has nothing. No, you don't have to.
Okay.
But mm-hmm. it's the same thing as going into any kind of private store. Any kind of private company, they can say, hey, this is our requirements for entering, just like a bar. You can't enter till you're 21, or you have to wear a collared shirt, or, you know, restaurant. I don't think restaurants do nowadays, but maybe some bigger cities still require a tie to go into your restaurant.
Yes, restaurants have dress codes, yeah.
Yeah, so there are certain requirements private mm-hmm. institutions can install, and if one of them is proving that you are vaccinated, then that's not a HIPAA violation because you
no,
are.
No, that's
you are
that's a.
That
yeah, see, I was calling
it
a different violation.
You have the choice. Mm-hmm. You have the choice to disclose that information or not, and that's not HIPAA. HIPAA is only basically a doctor disclosing mm-hmm. health information without permission. And it goes as far as, for me, for example, since I'm in a clinic, mm-hmm. I can't even say hi to one of my parents that I see inside the store because that could be indication that those kids are patients of mine.
Well, that's wild.
Yeah, it goes that far. And it's more about on the psychiatric end mm-hmm. where, like, if a psychiatrist sees one of their patients in the store, he or she's supposed to ignore them because if someone knows that that's a psychiatrist and that psychiatrist knows that person, oh, you're seeing a psychiatrist, you're nuts. So it's indirectly
that's a good
disclosing
protection.
Information.
That makes sense. Yeah. But here's something that we disagreed on before is the extent to which companies, private companies, can restrict people. Now here's where I see it is not a big deal. Shoes and shirt, you know, or no service. If you have a very ultra-high-class restaurant that requires a tie, that's not a life-changing event. Whereas a mask, you know, that has all kinds of microbes and bacteria and all kinds of crap that's growing in your petri dish in front of your face, that could be a life-changing event. You know, the idea of forcing people to get a vaccine before they go into a store, that's a life-changing event. That's a constitutional violation. So I would draw a line. I would draw a line at things that are inconvenient maybe for you or different, but the store wants, that's fine. Shoes and shirt, hey, listen, come in. Don't come in wearing shorts and bare feet, okay? That makes sense because that's not a life-changing event. But where I would draw the line, I want to see where you agree with this or not, that a vaccine, so even disclosing it or anything, that's nobody's business. And I don't believe in the vaccine passports. I don't believe in segregating society on those who've had a spike protein injection and those that haven't. You know, the people that are not getting this are doing it for very good reasons. And so you can't discriminate them in the course of regular business in the same way that you can't discriminate against a black person like was done in the, you know, before civil rights. You know, to me, to discriminate against someone that doesn't have a vaccine is exactly the same thing. It's still discrimination, you know, based on something that people, well, in one case you're born with and the other you choose not to get. But it's not the same thing as an inconvenience of throwing on, you know, a shirt and shoes. So that's why I say the companies cannot take away your constitutional rights in conducting business. It's still public accommodation. They still have to accommodate the public. And the public includes people who have had a vaccine and people who have not. So I think they have to be just as accommodating to people who have not had a vaccine as those who have. They don't have the right to do that because that would be a constitutional violation because they're requiring a life-changing event. Whereas I don't see any problem with shirt and shoes. You see the difference I'm making here? Does it make sense or no?
I understand what you're saying. And I mean, and I'm in agreement. Okay, first of all, I want to agree. But I could also be the devil's advocate here and say it could end up being a life-changing event. And they've brought the case out very well, and the public has sold it hook, line, and sinker, is that, well, the public health safety is that you're not vaccinated and you just germinated grandma. And now grandma died because of it.
But it's constantly pissed on the line right now.
No,
not an argument.
No, yeah. Let me finish. Let me say is that I would say, well, if grandma's that compromised to picking up sickness that easy, she shouldn't be out of the house if she's that concerned. That's my first thing I would say. And, you know, and it's the same thing during flu season. You know, and I know many old people who don't go outside during flu season because they're afraid to catch the flu because – you know, they could end up dead, basically. You know, and so I know that they don't because of it. And this is no different as to, you know, if you are that nervous or scared about it, don't go outside. You know,
it's not my responsibility.
Life-changing events.
Yeah, it's not my responsibility to get a vaccine to protect you. It's your responsibility to protect yourself.
So what responsibility is it of the business then? Because right now the laws that are in place, OSHA, you know, I sent you the OSHA laws a couple months ago, basically saying businesses have to protect their employees from this disease and have to do everything possible. So, you know, obviously it's a gray area, but, you know, and that's why you're seeing so many firings right now because people aren't getting vaccinated is because the easiest way to get OSHA off of the business's back is just saying, okay, we're making everyone be vaccinated, so therefore we're safe. So we don't have to do all these other protocols in its place.
But the irony of this is that if they really want to keep their employees safe, they would insist that they don't get it. You know, because the science is proving that the spike protein infusion is downright dangerous. People are dying from it. People are being injured from it. They're getting spike protein infusions. If they inject the vaccine directly into an artery or a vein, it goes to the heart. The spike proteins are made there. The heart gets scarred. It swells up with myocarditis. You're injecting young people that have no business being injected because their immunity is statistically 100%. You know, so if they really want to protect people, the best thing to do is make sure that your workforce is not vaccinated. Kind of ironic, but that's the way it works. Well, so they're actually advising, they're requiring something dangerous under the auspices of requiring something to make people safer, but it's actually not making people safer. That's the crazy part about it. So that's why the company shouldn't be in the business of doing that. They just should not be in the business of requiring or not requiring, you know, vaccines either for their employees or for their customers. Customers because of public accommodation, their employees because of constitutional rights. The Constitution does not subordinate itself to public health policies. It just doesn't.
Right, and you saw In-N-Out Burger in San Francisco who pulled out, which, by the way, I've always loved In-N-Out Burger when I lived in Phoenix. I just love going there. It's one of the best.
Did you just say
In-N-Out
Burger who pulled out?
Yeah, I guess I did, didn't I? So they went in and they went out.
Okay. Just want to clarify that. Pianki, you want to join the conversation here? We're here having a little bit of fun. I'm always having fun with Bill, so I'm so glad he called. Pianki, what do you think?
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I was going to say on the money concern,
uh-huh.
You know, police stop you on the street and you got just cash your check. Well, they'll confiscate that money until you prove where you got it, and where you got it was legal.
Exactly.
And as they count, you may have $500, and they may count and write down on the envelope that they counted $480. Well, now you got to prove you had $500 and that they didn't steal it. That's the way it works now.
Yeah.
And OSHA was never meant of course, it is being used now, to be used the way they're being used. What else, as an employer, is supposed to protect you? Suppose you come down with COVID. Now, do you get to go on workers' compensation?
Yes, you do.
How about the secondary injury fund? Does it apply?
Does the secondary injury fund apply? Yeah, you file the workers' comp claim because that's what we did last year because we didn't know what we're going to do at the time because it was all brand new. So we filed it as workers' comp. Workers' comp, paid the claim. Of course, going through workers' comp, you got to jump through so many hoops. It's just very annoying. It's a workers' comp claim that you file. In Florida, they pretty easily, but I'm understanding some other states, they're really giving employees a hard time about paying that claim. So I can only speak about Florida and my personal experience with it. But, yeah, it's a workers' comp claim. Even though it's not an injury, it's something that happened at work. So, therefore, they pay the claim.
Yeah. Well, how do they know that it happened at work? And also, when you file those claims, when that employer takes on those claims, then that raises their modifier number where their workers and compensation can go clean through the roof.
Okay, so the difference between an accident and a sickness, with this, thank goodness that they did label this a pandemic because it allowed us not to have to pay a higher rate. It's kind of like an excused absence sort of thing where, they're not, just like unemployment benefits. We even though I've laid some people off, our rate is still at the very lowest because the percentages over the years has been so low that I have a little bit of a forgiveness period, a little cushion more or less. And the same thing workers' comp claim. We filed three last year, and it's the first three that I've filed in 11 years, or 12 years actually. So our rate is still very low because of that. And then but I don't know all the details on the other side. I'm sure that there was some money that was given from the federal government to the states to kind of compensate for this. But what you brought up a good point is that how do you prove that you got it at work? Clinic, we get exposed to COVID at least once a week. The chances are that, someone probably did get it there, but I don't know 100%. There's no way to prove it.
No.
Go ahead.
And people who have been vaccinated also are spreading the disease. But here's the other point, too. Occupational health and safety. I'm supposed to provide my employees with the equipment so that they don't fall off the building. I am providing them with safety. So with this thing that you call in COVID, how are the employer going to provide them with what called safety? Heck, you can catch it through the air. Can we just tell them they need to wash their hands every time they use the bathroom? This is very more complicated than just a little falling and bumping your knee or falling off a building. And it really doesn't make any sense.
Well, it is. And what we use here, I mean, we put extreme safety measures into place in order just to meet our OSHA guidelines because we're not making our staff, it's not mandatory for our staff to get a vaccine. So we're doing it the hard way. And the hard way is that everyone stays in their car if they have any symptoms from COVID, which is basically the common cold. We go out, we test them. But when they go out and test them, it looks like that they're going into surgery because they got their protective gown on, they got a mask on, they got a shield on, they got their gloves on. But I have to pay all that out of my personal pocket. That comes out of my pocket, all those added expenses that we don't get reimbursed for, but that's what I'm doing in order to protect them as best as humanly possible. And knock on wood, we haven't had a case since we started doing the protocol. And if people come in and if people test positive for COVID at while they're sitting in their car, they don't come in the office and we send them on their way. Otherwise, if they test negative, then they come inside and then we go ahead and treat them like we normally would treat them. So those are some of the precautions we do. But once again, we're a doctor's office, which, you know, sick people come into our office. So, you know, we just try to figure out a way to treat them. As far as other businesses go, like right now I'm sitting in front of Home Depot, you know, they can't test every single person that walks through the door. So, you know, and they have safety measures in place, but their employees are not doing those safety measures. And that's the right of that employee. Now, the question is that since that employee is not wearing a mask, or he's not, or he or she is not behind the guarded plastic that they have, and not wearing a mask or wearing a shield, and they catch COVID, is Home Depot responsible for paying workers' comp for that? And my thing would be no, because the employee did not do everything they were supposed, you know, that was given to them to protect themselves. But that's where the gray area comes in.
How about the flu or any disease? You know, airborne viruses get around plastic screens. You can't hold the company responsible for that, but neither can they, you know, but the company can't say that you got it because you didn't do what we told you to do. In an airborne virus, it's easy to prove the masks don't work. It's easy to prove, you know, a bunch of other things. There's no reason for any of this, and it's not OSHA's mission to deal with this stuff. OSHA is responsible for maintaining a safe workplace with things that the job controls. If you work for a paint company, you're going to have a paint mask. If you work for a company with small dust particles, you're going to have a dust mask. You know, if you're a surgeon, you're going to have a surgical mask. You know, there are things that they do. There's all kinds of really good legislation on hazardous materials, and they have material data sheets, and they have, you know, eye washing stuff that they require. And if you're injured, they have protective clothing, all kinds of things. That's what OSHA does. OSHA is not in the health business or the disease business. They're in the health business as far as protecting you from chemicals, substances, injuries, you know, construction injuries, protective equipment, things and practices. That's what OSHA does. The idea that they can even get into vaccines is not even close to their mission. So, Gene, before we go, we've got Jonathan on the line too. I'm going to get to him in just a minute. But, Gene, if you can look up OSHA, look up exactly their charter stuff, or just go to their about section and then let me know what specifically they're doing, because they're being misused here. They're being misused, and Congress should have oversight of it. Congress should be saying OSHA is not in the business of vaccines. In fact, that's not their job. Their job is protective clothing, protective practices, you know, protective, things like that. That's what they're supposed to do. Pianca, I'm going to go to you, and then Bill, and I'll get to we'll bring Jonathan in. Pianca, have I got that pretty much covered,
OSHA
or what?
OSHA came into business, I guess, in the 1980s. And our industry, which is steel erection, had to have a meeting with them because the people don't know nothing about the business and how activities, the procedures had been going on for actually since 1890.
Yeah, people
and
fell off buildings.
They had to be scooped.
They fell off. You know, the people would walk across open steel, construction workers. I mean, the Golden Gate Bridge is famous for one of the first, this is back in the 30s, for one of the first things that actually had a net. That was unheard of. What do you mean? You're going to save the workers? No, we're just, you know, it's cheaper to let them go. You know, and so that's OSHA does some really good things. You know, you don't want people falling off buildings. You want them having belts and secure measures and things when they're doing work on open steel. That makes sense. Did you have a problem with that company?
Well, yes, but there's a way that things have to be done, and the way that a person that look at something from the ground and try to determine how it should be done, they need to consult the people that's been doing it for 100 years.
Let
me ask you another question. You had an incident there in Philadelphia where a woman, a female, was raped on a public bus. People watched, and the individual that done the rape was illegal. Now, who is responsible for that? Who picks up that liability?
You know, I want to talk about that. I got Jonathan. I want to get his opinion. He's a criminal defense attorney. Bill, I want to make sure. Do you have a couple minutes, or do you have to go? Because I want to give you the last word before
you have to go. I got to go earn my dollar for today. Of course, the way the tax is about to increase, I got to go earn my 75 cents. So
inflation.
Inflation.
The dollar's not worth 75
cents. It's only not even worth a penny anymore, but that's beside the point. But you guys have a good rest of the show, and we'll talk soon.
Well, I look forward to your return to the regular Thursday slot. I'm keeping it open for you. So feel free when you're ready. Thanks, Bill. I guess Bill left. Say something nice. He's not even there for it. All right, let me play Jonathan's theme. We're going to get back to Bianchi's question, which I think is something that we absolutely have to discuss. And I just found out about it this morning, but that's okay. We'll be right back. It probably started with an episode of Perry Mason many years ago. That yearning to understand the law, so that you can help people who don't understand the law. The arguments, the debates, the mental trial beyond the actual trial, all the while trying to do the best you can for your client. He walks the halls of justice, pictures on the wall of great minds who advance the law. He walks not in the black robes of the judge, but the suit and tie of the attorney. Known as counselor, lawyer, or any number of other names, and after years of hard work, these are the people accepted to the bar and allowed to practice law, especially at trial. For it is at trial, many times, that the great decisions of our society are realized. It's where the laws get tested. It's where juries have lost their power to judge the laws and not just the facts. It's where judges make up their own law, especially through interpretations. But if you are ever in trouble, your attorney can be your best friend. We are privileged at Action Radio to have one of those practitioners of the law, someone who knows the Constitution, who knows about due process, who takes the rights of the individual as sacred and will fight for them with all he's got. It is at this time every week that we immerse ourselves in the law. So join us in the law as we go to the Action Radio Legal Report with Jonathan Mosley. Okay, I wanted to get Jean on the OSHA if she had that, but we've got a call in, so we'll find out who our new caller is. Let's get to, I want to bring Jonathan Pianki up live here. Pianki presented me with an incredible, well, actually, Jean, do you have the OSHA definition? Then we'll get to Pianki's question, which I want to spend a few minutes on.
Yeah, it says, well, the purpose of OSHA was created by Congress in 1970 to ensure safe and healthful working conditions for workers by setting and enforcing standards and by providing training, outreach, education, and assistance. The mission is to save lives, prevent injuries, and protect the health of American workers.
Okay. Nothing to do with vaccines or medical procedures or anything like that.
It's supposed to develop job safety and health standards and enforce them through the worksite inspections, maintaining reporting and record-keeping systems to keep track of job-related injuries and illnesses. But I've never heard of OSHA regulating the flu shot or any other thing, so I'm not sure.
Well, that would be a drug, so we would think that would come under Food and Drug Administration. But we'll hash that out in a little bit. Thank you, because I wanted to get a definition. It pretty much confirmed what I said, that they have no business doing vaccine regulation, which is not a vaccine anyway. All right, Jonathan and Pianki, you're both live, so any background noise we're going to hear. It's just kind of how it works. Jonathan, I want Pianki to state that this story that he sent me that is just horrifying. For a bunch of reasons, but Pianki, why don't you lay out the case and the story, and then I'm curious Jonathan's reaction. Pianki?
Well, the story is that on a Philadelphia public service transportation, a female was raped by an illegal for at least 30 minutes as passengers watched and even some film on their cameras. Now, my question is this. Being that the government is trying to throw these stipulations around COVID and the workplace and letting that come underneath of OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Act. Mm-hmm. Well, what about this incident? Who can be liable for that, for what happened to this young lady? Was not the transit system supposed to provide safety and protection for its passengers?
Jonathan, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Traditionally, believe it or not, one of the odd things about one is not responsible to report a crime. I'm just reading something in Pennsylvania law here, for example, if somebody gets involved, then they may be responsible for how it happens, but there's no bystander liability. An exception to that is something called misprision of felony, which is in federal law, and I was just trying to check if that applied to Pennsylvania law. It is a crime not to report a felony. Which is a departure from the traditional. I mean, it was a traditional idea and kind of strange that one did not have, a bystander did not have an obligation to do anything, but the statutes on misprision of felony were an exception to that common law. I'd have to see whether that applies to Pennsylvania state law. Now, this was on a public transportation, is that right? I mean, it's possible that federal law might apply.
Yes, it was. And let me add one more thing, too, Jonathan. There was a case years ago where a woman got raped in a pool hall on the pool table, and the other players stood around and watched and didn't do anything, and they were charged.
I remember that. That was Boston.
No, that was Boston, Massachusetts. So what I'm saying is under federal law, it's not used very much, sadly, but there is a federal law that would require someone to report the felony, report the crime. I don't know if Pennsylvania law has that. Massachusetts probably did. And I think that they tried to argue that by standing around and cheering or something and blocking view or something, they may have aided and abetted it as well as just watched. if this is, for example, an interstate, this is Philadelphia, there are three states nearby there. If this is a public transportation that goes interstate or is regulated in something, then federal law may apply, and that would make it a misprision of felony. Now, they're trying, for example, on January 6th, to accuse Trump and these other people of, of misprision of a felony, meaning they failed to stop the supposed riots. So, I mean, as recently as this, as this month, they're trying to charge under that statute. But it's kind of a wrinkle between traditional common law and attempts to fix that someone might have an obligation like that, might have a duty. And it's clearly unsatisfactory that the old common law didn't require one to intervene. Especially now, the issue is does someone have an obligation to get directly involved or merely to call the police?
So that's what I want to know about. In fact, we actually have another caller for you, too. I'm going to just jump in here for a second before we tackle this, and I want to find out how that person wants to be identified because they have a question as well. But here's two things that are bugging me the most. One is that nobody did anything. Two, that they filmed it and didn't do anything. Three, that they didn't call it in. And fourth, this is an illegal alien that shouldn't have been here in the first place. Jonathan, what the hell's going on?
You know, another point, too.
Hold on.
Another point.
I want to know about the liability of people when you're staring at a crime. It's one thing to not do anything because you might not want to get involved for your personal safety. It's another thing to film it. Now, are they filming it allegedly to get the person arrested, in which case I understand that. But are they filming it because they want to share it on Facebook? At what point do we have a civic responsibility to do something, not just stand there and
video? That's where, as I recall, the Boston incident, I think, I'd have to go back and check it, but I believe there was an element of them saying that they tried to say that the crowd did more than just watch.
Right.
That I think by standing around so that I think blocking the pool table rate from being visible to others,
right.
That I think they were charged with aiding and abetting it, not just watching, but actually participating.
That actually was made into a movie. Jodie Foster, I think, was the victim in that film. And so this is a well-known case. I've forgotten the name of the person who was the victim, but this is pretty well-known stuff. Did that change any laws? And then I want to get to another. We have a lot of issues. We were wondering what to talk about this morning. We got more issues than I know what to do with. This is great. But did that change any laws there? And does that affect the Philadelphia case?
It was because it was such a big deal. I'd have to go through the Pennsylvania law. I'm seeing things here. It could be obstruction of justice, but I am sure that it made a lot of wrinkles, and I'm sure that Massachusetts law got tweaked.
Well, let me get to one more Pianchi point, and then I want to find out if the government's liable for the illegal aliens they're bringing in. Pianchi, go ahead.
See, this is how this gets complicated. There was a case in St. Louis County in Delwood. A lady by the name of Eleanor Reasoner was in a gas station when some people came in and she left and they killed the gasoline attendant. She called and reported what she saw and ended up being accused of the crime, being tried, and was one vote away from the jurors of being put to death. Now, much, much later on, it found out that the police chief had the information that would have freed her in his bottom drawer.
Yeah, exculpatory.
He had another case. And, you know, let me give you this case. So, by liability. He had another case where a witness came forth and testified. It was the Missouri Brawler case down on 12th of Washington. He testified, but they did not maintain his anonymity. They didn't protect him as a witness, and he ended up getting assassinated. So these cases like this, what we're talking about with this COVID, this is opening up a whole can of worms.
Let me get a response to that, Jonathan.
Yeah.
And I want to get I'm not quite clear on the connection, but I want to get to my caller, and then we can Bianchi. We have more stories.
Point,
Jonathan's going to be here for a bit.
Of,
yeah.
You know,
go ahead, Jonathan.
Bianchi's point sort of explains itself. I agree with those concerns.
Okay.
Virginia has passed a new law recently as a special exception that someone who, in fact, I had a case dropped because of this. That my client. Because of what they call Good Samaritan law, which is that if somebody is in danger of overdosing of a drug overdose and somebody reports it, they won't be prosecuted for being, you know, for being involved in the drug use. It specifically passed the law so that to encourage people to get medical help, life-saving medical help, because otherwise that can happen. They'll say, and I'm, you know, very concerned that a lot of times the police they can't find the person who actually did it, so they just
whoever's
grab
closest.
Anybody they can to prosecute. Anyway, go ahead.
That's another problem. All right, now I want to hold you up just for a second because I got a new caller to the show, and I want to know if they want to be identified first name or just caller, and has a question for you, Jonathan. And so our new person on the show, do you want me to call you by first name? I know who you are, but you're on with Jonathan Mosley, our legal expert, criminal defense attorney, constitutional attorney, and a bunch of other stuff. Go ahead, new person.
You can use my first name.
Okay, so this is Wallace. And had contacted me earlier about a question looking for some legal help. And so, and Bianchi, like I say, we'll get to your stories too, because you got some good cases on report, but I want to get our new person in here with Jonathan. So state your case and question and enter and sign in, please, as they used to say, and how can we help?
Well, in 2020, I made some comments on a Facebook post about a very prominent builder here in the area in Santa Rosa County. And he sent me a letter from his lawyer and told me I was supposed to take them down. I couldn't remember all the places I had posted it. So
we don't
I did
need to
try.
Who that is, so we'll keep the person that you posted about. We'll keep them secret for now, but I'll ask Jonathan about that. But yeah, this is kind of intriguing. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I tried to take most of them down. After that, I went and spoke out against him at a county commission meeting. I had posted one picture of what the property looked like that he was developing. I said, you know, it's flooding. I made a couple other comments that I think were, you know, one was kind of political, one was a general statement.
How'd you get in trouble? What caused the legal problem?
What caused the legal problem? They said I didn't take down all the posts, and I cost him $30,000 in damages from that post.
And they wanted you to pay that or what?
Well, the lawsuit claimed that.
Oh, okay.
The lawsuit claimed that from those statements, that cost him $30,000.
Okay. But were you able to find some help with that? Did you know, who was on your side?
I did a GoFundMe. It has cost me almost $6,000, and the GoFundMe didn't fund, you know, all of that. So,
so you didn't have a lawyer defending you?
Yeah.
Okay.
I found a lawyer, and you know, his services cost me almost $6,000, and nothing came out of it. I cannot afford an attorney anymore. I've tried to get pro bono help. There is a new judge that has, you know, come in the circuit civil court, and he has instructed his attorneys to get with it and, you know, move forward on this case because it's been 2 years. And
so they still want,
they were in,
they still want the money, right? They still want the $30,000. They still want the $30,000 from you.
Well, now the story has changed. They say, well, now damages are minimal of $1,000, but of course, you know, anything else that the judge would like to add on to that, and plus now they want me to pay the attorney fees.
Let's bring Jonathan in, because this is representative of, I'm sure, a lot of people that are not in a position to afford, you know, expert legal help, and yet they need the system.
Well, there are still some things I'm not sure about. This is Florida, is that right?
This is Florida, yeah.
Yeah. Florida has a weak, what's called an anti-SLAPP statute, but it does have one. Which, I mean, on the one hand, defamation can still be defamation on the internet, and it's identifiable. That, you know, it is possible that one can be sued for making statements on there. However, defamation is a very difficult and tricky case, situation, and the courts have been become increasingly hostile to it, because I know I've been dealing with things since I worked at Judicial Watch in 1990, and I could see the law changing to make it more and more difficult to bring some of those cases. Larry Klayman likes to, you know, sue people for defamation, and it's becoming increasingly difficult. There's a case involving in the Florida federal court in the Southern District involving Dennis Montgomery, which if you or your lawyer were to look up, you'll see many of the arguments used to dismiss a case. But the thing is, there's also something called an Anti-SLAPP Act, which don't try to figure out what it means. That the name doesn't really mean anything as far as I can tell. But the idea is that when someone is engaged in acts of public participation, as they put it, then one cannot sue. For example, if you go to a government hearing, whatever you say there, they can't sue for that. Unless it's, you know, completely illegitimate, like I say, there's a proposal to add a street light, and I get up and I speak and I use it to talk about, you know, something completely different, that, you know, my girlfriend is a porn star or something, has absolutely nothing to do with the topic of the government hearing. But basically, if it's any government hearing and it's remotely relevant, that would be protected under the Anti-SLAPP Act, and they cannot sue you for that. I mean, they could sue you. Anybody can sue anybody, but they can't successfully sue you. And it requires that you or your attorney file a motion to dismiss under Florida's Anti-SLAPP Act. otherwise, of course, the issue about making statements is that if what you're saying is true, they say truth is a defense.
Truth is a bit, and it is true. I can prove it. So, yeah.
Right. So you if that would mean that you'd go, if you were to win, you'd ultimately ask for them to pay your attorney's fees.
Right.
You know, because the other thing too is if someone, see, that's what a SLAPP Act is. It's a strategic lawsuit against public participation. It's they sue you just to shut you up, illegitimately. So that's why there are responses. And if they knew that they didn't have a valid case, but they sued you just to shut you up, then they may, you know, they could possibly end up paying you, paying your attorney's fees for filing a frivolous lawsuit. So that's where it gets, and it becomes, you know, increasingly difficult to deal with whether or not it's opinion. you know, there are all kinds of exceptions to why courts dismiss defamation lawsuits more and more and make them, you know, very difficult to win. Basically, in my view, Larry and other people want to keep suing people. In my view, defamation lawsuits are basically dead. They've changed the law so much that it's basically impossible to win a defamation lawsuit. Now, the problem of getting a lawyer is, you know, is a really big problem. I'm not sure I have a solution for that, except that, you know, most people never pay me, so I don't know how all these people, all these lawyers get so much money and everything like that, because it's not happening.
That's because you do good work, Jonathan. You do good things.
What?
You're not being paid by people to shut other people up. You know, if you were a sleazy corporate lawyer, you'd be a lot richer, but you wouldn't have your soul. So, you know, that's the difference.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that's true. But I do know that it can be a real challenge to get a lawyer to defend you. But it does require some work there and, you know, trying to find some. Now, you know, in theory, lawyers are supposed to spend a certain amount of their time doing pro bono work, or what some people jokingly call like low bono work, meaning that, you know, in fact, on the January 6th demonstrations, you know, the riots, my client and I'm about to sign on a second one, you know, I'm charging him almost nothing. I'm not doing it for free because I can't afford to, but the rate I'm charging him is extremely low. There are attorneys who do that, though. As a pro bono thing, they'll charge an extremely low amount, and that sort of thing. But I haven't seen the case, of course, or what you said, or whatever. But you know, if it is frivolous, meaning it's defensible as a as truthful, then then you'd hope that a Florida attorney would be happy to take it and you know, try to get them to pay sue attorney's fees as a frivolous lawsuit. But you know, it is hard and it's time consuming to try to find a lot of lawyers. I mean, you could possibly go, you know, usually the state bar has a program where you pay them a modest amount, like $35, and they will connect you with a lawyer or you know, more than one to give you like a 30-minute consultation. And that's a way that sometimes turns into a case if you can find somebody to do that. So there are some very good defenses, but you may need to have somebody to help you with them.
Is there any?
I have tried everything I can think of. I've called a lot of places for pro bono, but I have been unsuccessful in that. So we are, they were told to create a management plan for the case, and we will go to mediation sometime next year in May. Right now they have submitted a request for a hearing for summary judgment, and this judge has already denied one of those requests. So I sent in an objection to that because it deviates from the management plan that I agreed to with them in good faith.
What's the management plan? I wonder what that is, Jonathan.
Case management.
So does it keep you out of court, or what does it do?
I assume it's a case. It's a case management plan, right?
The case is 2 years old. So the new judge, the new civil circuit judge, came in and told them, according to the certain Florida statutes, they have to clear this case from the courts because it has been so long.
So it's within the court is what she's saying. It's not like a management plan external to the court. It's how to handle the lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. Right. It tells.
And so what I would.
It tells the judge, okay, we're going to do this.
Hold on, Wallace. Hold on a bit.
What I would do is try to look up, things. Like I say, if you look up Dennis Montgomery in the federal court, you'll see what the other side argued in all of the, all the motions to dismiss. All the many reasons why they said that it was no good. If you should probably file a motion to dismiss under Florida's Anti-SLAPP Act, which you'll have to look up and to say that this is purely, it's clearly, like I say, they cannot sue you for what you said in a government hearing. You should deal with that and say that this is, obviously now, if you're saying something about people that is not true, I'm not endorsing that, but if you could say that what you said about them is true and it's not defamation because you were telling them something, you argue something that's true and it's perhaps in the interest of government decision making, then you should could try to dismiss it on those grounds. So
okay,
Dennis Montgomery against Houghton Mifflin. It was about a book by James Risen. I always confuse Rosen and Risen. saying that. It was all about Bush. I forget. It's hard to say. It was a public issue. It was a book about the intelligence agency in the Iraq War, and they went out of their way to smear Dennis Montgomery in the book. Now remember, I'm from Florida, but I'm not licensed in Florida, so I can only talk about generic ideas. So that's about the most I could suggest to you. It's very hard to find a lawyer, even though there's a glut of lawyers.
They want money.
It's very weird.
They want the big cases. Yeah. I got to jump in here. I got Josie on the line.
All right.
This is quite interesting. And the reason I wanted, this is why I'm glad Wallace called in, is because there's people who are going to face this. Every vaccine manufacturer is going to start suing people for speaking up. School boards, the various, there's going to be different departments. The more that we advocate in public, the more that we speak up in public hearings, the more of these lawsuits I think are going to be generated. This is why I think this is such a key, not just for our caller, the one person who's doing this, but this is an issue for everybody to think about. Is like how,
yes,
how pervasive
is
it going
to
be.
You're not allowed to
companies,
do that. You're supposed to.
Yeah. But people need to know
that. Kneel before God.
Because of this, another woman was threatened. She posted something on Facebook that was straight out of the commission agenda. And the builder came at her and sent her all kinds of letters and said, "Get down or I'm going to sue you." So, he followed the builders. It got to where, someone else was threatened because I was being sued.
They all talk to each other. Let me get Josie in the conversation. Josie, do you want to add to this? Welcome back.
Yes, I think this whole thing in America is so stupid. We're so worried about a comment that somebody makes on Facebook and not trying to arrest illegals or criminals in our country. We're wasting our wheels on stupidity. Because if this person made a comment, it's because she something happened. Like I made a comment on Facebook about my dentist being a stinking communist, making everybody wear a mask, And this is a freedom
don't
of speech
sugarcoat it,
Josie. America.
Just tell it like it is, okay? Just don't hold back. I want you to really get in.
Yeah, I do. I tell it like
ahead.
It is. I'm not afraid. And this is what America is. United we stand, and we need to stand against all these criminals, especially the judges are a bunch of criminals nowadays. They're all against conservative people. We cannot speak out our minds because they want to shut us off, and nobody's shutting me off. But this is ridiculous, and all the judges are in it. And I'm glad you tell it like it is, young lady or young man. I forgot the name that you said. But, you know, continue doing what you're doing. And it's just hopefully Trump is going to come back soon and we're going to arrest all these judges involved.
Well, the judges are a great
this.
Question. Josie raises an excellent point. You know, is like what if you have a bad judge, it doesn't matter what the law is. You know, they're going to screw with the case anyway. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's
correct.
That's true. Yeah. And he hasn't shut me up. I still go to the meetings when he has issues on the agenda, and I know that it won't be good for the public. So myself and my friends show up at meetings. It's not only me to try to stop some of the things, you know. He's done. He's been very, very involved in the Land Development Code. So here you have a prominent builder making the Land Development Codes. So
maybe you can investigate them and see if they're breaking the law and use that as a defense. But Jonathan, would this be good advice for Wallace just to keep speaking, to keep, you know, staying in public, to show consistency, to try and find ordinances that perhaps this builder is breaking and bring those to the attention? Is it city council or is it county commission? Wallace, who are you speaking before?
County commission.
Okay. So, Jonathan, what do you think? Continued participation shows sincerity. Does that make a difference in a lawsuit or other tactics you can use?
I don't know that by itself that makes a difference. She's got to assert in the lawsuit that this is a lawsuit to shut down someone who is participating in the government process. I mean, if she doesn't assert that in the lawsuit, I don't think it will make any difference. But she's got to do it. She's got to assert that this concerns the ability of a citizen to petition the government. It's not, you know, it's like if they just built her house wrong or something, and then it was untrue what she said, they might have a good lawsuit. But if it concerns changes to government policy or something like that, then
or violations of government policy, violations of law.
Well,
for
yeah. Right, but if somebody then asks the judge to dismiss the case because it's you're addressing issues of public policy, an unbiased judge should dismiss the case. Now, like I said, when Larry Klayman founded Judicial Watch in 1994, it was called Judicial Watch because of bad judges. Then the Clintons came along and it grew into a political thing, but the original purpose was actually to watch all the bad judges and do something about them. So unfortunately that is a problem. But on the other hand, it's like my friend Norm Bradford will say, if you may get the right answer to the wrong question. So most judges won't help you I've seen a judge almost do that. To sort of beg you to are you going to ask for XYZ? You know, kind of like head exploded.
Yeah, and lawyer
say,
shows.
Yeah.
Which right, you say, do you think a summary judgment might be a good idea? Yeah,
what about XYZ? He says, granted. You know, but most of the time the judges are just going to sit there and wait for you to ask the question.
Right.
You know, so you have to ask that question that what you said was the truth. They haven't shown it's not truth. And it's a request for government, you know, for government review. So it's not a valid lawsuit.
Yeah.
Right. Well,
we've got Claire on the line. I'm going to bring her in a few minutes when we switch to foreign policy, intelligence, and other matters. But this is fascinating. I also have Pianchi, Gene, our producer, still on the line too, obviously. And we've got Josie, who's on the line too. So let's go around a little bit. See, just you can make it more general, advocacy in general, you know, being prosecuted for speaking your mind, which to me is a First Amendment violation. This is what I think they really do. This is a constitutional issue. I see it's a blatant violation of
well, I was going to say, hold on a second. I don't. I'm a little concerned about not being able to get to anything else, but the,
okay.
It is. No, I forgot what I was going to say.
This is what we
plan
to talk about, but it just kind of happened. We'll pick it up next week, Jonathan. These issues aren't going to go away. We got plenty of time to cover this. But this is, you know, I always go with callers and people who want to bring up an issue. Even if we had planned other stuff, because I think it's more important to get the participation of people. And so if we don't get to, you know, I think we pretty answer to one of the questions. So also what you can do, you don't have to take notes. You know, you're going to get a podcast. About an hour from now, our show will be podcast. And so then you can go over and listen to all the things that Jonathan said, because he has a ton of good advice for you, of places you can go with this.
Okay.
All right. So you're welcome to stick around if you want, or if you have to go, that's okay too. Jonathan, let's take a few minutes, and if there's like one particular thing that we really need to know this week, let's cover that, and then we'll bring Claire in and find out the international scene.
Which one are you thinking of?
I don't know. I've got like 12 listed.
Well, let me tell you one thing. You want to talk about the Virginia governor's race, which
let's
you
do
know,
that.
Can take
let's
us an hour easily.
That. Yeah, that's critical.
And,
yeah.
But what's happening just now is that a conservative group that I know, the signers, Christine Brim, I've talked to her about election integrity going back three or four years before the, this latest thing. They just filed a lawsuit because the Monmouth poll just came out and found that Terry McAuliffe, who is the Democrat, who is the former head of the Democrat National Committee and under Clinton. So he's got contacts everywhere. He's got a golden Rolodex. He can raise unlimited amounts of money. And he's been elected before.
He was governor before, wasn't
and,
he? Like a few years
yes,
ago?
Yes, he was governor before, and he was a Clinton supporter before, which people are not paying much attention to. The latest poll, and of course there are polls all over the place, has the governor's race in Virginia 46-46. And they've been saying it's been tight, but still McAuliffe has been ahead. There's two polls now showing he's not ahead. And as you were mentioning when we were talking off air, the D.C. suburbs, Fairfax County, Alexandria County, Arlington County, to some extent Loudoun, where you're seeing all the uproar about parents and school boards, they have a very high concentration of government employees. And also all the trade groups and lobbyists and interest groups and companies that benefit from government, they have people living all throughout there. So what happens is that the Richmond area goes Democrat. The vast majority of Virginia geographically votes Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the Virginia suburbs that decide elections one way or the other. And Virginia has been trending Democrat. And there's a simple reason why the Democrats have been gaining power in Virginia. It's that Republicans are dumb, as usual. It's like the Democrats don't win. Republicans lose because we're stupid politically. Same thing in Delaware and everything like that. The Republican Party of Virginia is a worthless waste of space. The new chairman, Rich Anderson, is better than abysmal, but it's still not doing its job. So we now have Virginia going. There's a very real chance that Biden is so unpopular. As we said last night, the problem with this whole public school thing and the school boards is that the Democrats have relied upon certain interest groups, including government employees, minorities, and mostly suburban women. And what they've been doing over the last year and a half is hacking off the suburbs. So the Democrats have been, doing everything they can to alienate and anger suburban women in particular. So today we have a lawsuit just out that Fairfax County is bigger than 8 states. It's enormous. It's violating the absentee rules. So there's a lawsuit up.
Absentee voting rules?
Yesterday.
Okay.
Same nonsense. The voting rules for absentee ballots. They're not enforcing the rules. You know, they're accepting absentee ballots and absentee ballot applications that violate the laws on the books. Now, you remember, because Action Radio is a party to the brief we filed in the U.S. Supreme Court, which was only one of two briefs in the 2020 election cases where Clarence Thomas actually mentioned two briefs, and then he went on and gave his long speech, much of which, not all of it, but maybe a third of which sort of sounded like our brief, that in 2020 the states violated the written rules. Now, there's all questions about whether it's fraud or not and everything like that, but there's no question whatsoever that the Constitution in Article 2, Section 1 says that for a presidential election, the state legislatures set the rules, not the governor, not the election officials, not the Secretary of State, not the courts, the legislature. Because
right.
It's a federal function, it's not a state function. It's like, well, normally wouldn't the state court have a say? It's not a state function. It's the federal Constitution deputizing the legislature to perform a federal function to choose the next president. Anyway, so that, you know, there's no question that hundreds of changes were made across the country in violation of the Constitution. Well, they're doing it again. So under the radar, this group discovered that they're accepting absentee ballots and absentee ballot applications in violation of Virginia's statutes. And so because Fairfax,
and that's the group name under the radar. They're called Under the Radar. That's the group name, because I want to look them up.
No. I'm just saying that the first we heard about it, like when they were doing it during COVID, it was a big public discussion that, you know, oh, we have to change the rules, and they went to courts and got courts to change the rules. But here, this has just been happening quietly until the Virginia Institute for Public Policy filed a lawsuit, and so that was filed in Circuit Court of Fairfax County by the Virginia Institute for Public Policy. It was filed yesterday at 8 in the morning, and they're asking for an injunction. Now, previously,
I want to get to Claire. I'm going to bring her into this in a second here. Who are they filing it with?
With who? What do you mean?
Where are they filing it in the
state Fairfax County Circuit Court, which is a state court.
Okay.
Which it's a huge court. We've got many. There's my friend Stephen Hunt, is one of the plaintiffs. They've got many a huge number of judges, and they range from great to horrible. So who knows? And this will probably be grabbed by the chief judge. We'll be hearing what that happens. But the Democrats previously appealed publicly to have the laws changed. And Glenn Youngkin, the Republican, the outsider Republican running for governor, responded that, you know, we're in the middle of voting. You can't have early voting and absentee ballots that have already been cast.
Right. You can't change the rules.
Somewhere under one set of rules.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah. Well, let me hold you up there for a bit. I want to bring Claire. This is fascinating. I think the Virginia race is indicative of what's going on. I still contend that the greatest national security threat, which is more Claire's area, is election fraud. You know, we lost the president over it. And as much as I hope to get him back, I think it might be better in 2024. Mm. I'll talk about that sometime. But Claire, you're up that way. But, you know, do you... What's your opinion about the Virginia race, you know, from what you know of it? And do you see this as still the number one threat to our national security in terms of having Biden installed in the White House and what's going on around the world with China and Afghanistan and everything else? That elections are like the one thing, if nothing else gets corrected, that is the most important thing right now to do. And the governor's race in Virginia is proving that the problems are still there. Claire?
Well, yeah, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Yeah, I do live in Northern Virginia, although I'm in Prince William County, which is further south than the more closer in suburbs that you were talking about, including Fairfax County. But, of course, following the governor's race, I'll be voting in a couple of weeks. I vote in person on the day of Election Day at my local elementary school is where we go. Wanted to bring something to your all, the attention of you all, and that is something that I learned from the excellent research done by Trevor Loudon. And that is that as long ago as a dozen years ago, a professor at George Mason University, whose specialty is spatial mapping, data mining, his name is Steve McClure, American citizen, moved to Wuhan, China. Can you imagine? And there, he went to work for an institute in Wuhan, China.
Can we guess which one?
Pardon?
I said, can we guess which one?
Well, sure. Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying this is the Wuhan Institute of Virology, right? I mean, that's the only one we know of.
No, no. He's a data mining specialist.
So this is a different one, then.
He does data spatial analysis.
What's spatial analysis?
What he was doing, has been doing in China, I believe he's still there, is working with the Chinese Communist Party on specifically U.S. election campaigns, and in particular in his home state of Virginia, helping the Democrat Party and what do they call it, the New Virginia Majority, I think might be the name of the group, working with them to help flip Virginia blue, or bluer. And what they do is they slice and dice the electorate, meaning here are the Hispanic communities, this is where the soccer moms are strong, here are African-American neighborhoods, and they slice and dice that way and then target those communities, people in them, for certain messaging. This is what they do. This is what his specialty is. And he's working with the Chinese Communist Party. Just thought that was a little bit interesting.
No, this is more than just interesting. And I'm wondering if he's working with social media, which that's their job too, because they do their advertising and marketing, and they take all our personal information and put it through their algorithms and sell us advertising.
No, that's not his focus. It's data mapping, data spatial.
Which is what? What exactly?
Mapping.
What is that?
Well, it's slicing and dicing the geography of, let's say, Northern Virginia communities. Here live all the soccer moms in the suburbs. Here are the Hispanic communities. That's what I'm saying. That's what they do. And
is
then
that...
they target those communities for special messaging, be it door knocking or flyers or you know, other kinds of TV ads, what have you.
Yeah, and Claire,
Jonathan, go ahead. Yeah.
We were talking offline with Greg about he said, why don't we analyze government employees as a separate voting group in Northern Virginia, which would certainly go along with what you're saying. Are they groups like, you know, is this information in the hands of people like Christine Brim, the Virginia Institute for Public Policy, or is it something we need to get to them?
You know, Christine and I are good friends going back many years. She preceded me working at the Center for Security Policy before she left, and then after I got kicked out last year. So I did not know that she was active in this group. I should follow up with her. I've not been in touch for a bit.
Let's bring her on the show. Let's talk to her.
I think that'd be a great idea. Tell me the name of the group again that she's working with.
It says the Virginia Institute for Public Policy.
Okay. I'll get in touch with her. I did not know about her work there, but I should touch base.
I'll send you the lawsuit.
Okay. Thank you.
You guys talk off the air. You're connected in Facebook. We're all a big happy family.
Uh-huh.
This is fascinating that you're this close. I'll bring Pianki back on the conversation, too, see if he has something to add on Virginia voting or just voting in general. Pianki, welcome. We've got Jonathan and Claire and Gene and me, and we've got our real Thursday crowded show today. Yeah, go ahead, Pianki.
You know, you had a guest on your show last week. What was his name? Pulley? Something like that.
Oh, John Cullen?
And he made mention that he wrote a program back in 1982 that's being used today by a member, I think, of the CCP that's working for the CDC that's putting out the map on the COVID spread, the virtual map.
This is interesting. Now, John Cullen is the one who has some fascinating evidence that what we're seeing now is the Spanish flu that was resurrected by actually taking lung tissue from someone who died in 1918, frozen up in the tundra, and genetically analyzed and coded and brought back. And that's why a lot of the cytokine storm, the lung filling up, people are drowning in their own fluids. That's actually a Spanish flu virus. And I'm still investigating that, so I'm not going to say one way or the other. It's just fascinating. But what he did, he used to work for Oracle. And he was in the Bay Area when I was there. And I remember Oracle was a huge company. That's Larry Ellison. He used to fly his jet into, San Jose Airport after curfew, and he didn't care. But Oracle was huge. And what John Cullen did was he actually invented the technology for mapping. And the map that Johns Hopkins used to display COVID all over the world, those red dots and things, was John Cullen's technology. That was his map. And what he found so fascinating is that whereas Vietnam had maybe 100 deaths from COVID total, their whole map was red. So they found a way not only to use the map, but redirect the map and actually put fraudulent information into it. So it was a fascinating show. It was a week ago Thursday. And so if anybody – no, it was last Thursday. I'm sorry. Yeah, so it was a week ago. Anybody wants to get that show, but that's what happened. So mapping – but this is a different kind of mapping. The mapping that Claire is talking about is demographic mapping as opposed to geographical. I think I've got my point. Yeah, all right. Go ahead, Jonathan.
So along with what Claire was bringing up, and I know at some point – we may be stepping on her topics, but there is an HBO special mm-hmm. called Brexit, which every political person should watch. And it's not about Brexit in terms of the arguments or the substance. It's about exactly what, the kinds of things that Claire was talking about, which is
okay.
how they use renegade techniques to find, for example, the people who never vote. And got them to vote they don't go into how they did it, but they agree with what Claire is saying that they were doing it. They won the Brexit vote by sophisticated data mapping and data techniques that I think we would do well to understand. And
here's a question for both of you on that. Working for the Chinese Communist Party, obviously, is, as far as I'm concerned, treason. I mean, this is the last group you want to work for. But the actual idea of data, of spatial mapping, of breaking all these groups up scientifically, is there anything illegal about what they're doing, or is it just very good and, rather disgusting? Claire, what do you think?
No, it's not illegal. It's and there's nothing illegal about going to work for a foreign company either. Okay. The information that Steve McClure is sharing or his expertise that he's sharing is not classified information. It's his particular scientific, technological, area of expertise. It's academic. There's nothing illegal about it. It's despicable that he would do such a thing.
But if it's used to help China influence our election, does that cross over into illegality at that point? I would think it would.
No, it's the same. I mean, he's working with the Democrat Party. There's nothing illegal about it.
Okay. Jonathan?
Nefarious, but not illegal.
It would depend if foreign money was being used. It could possibly, especially in federal elections, the use of foreign country resources to directly influence it could happen, but of course you'll probably have several layers of of involvement, so I'm not sure just off the top of my head. Let me circle back a bit, and then I guess I don't know if Claire is going to jump to more
foreign
policy.
We'll get some
talks
to Claire.
I gotta
play one of our sponsors here, so I want to do something for about 2 minutes.
Well, let me just say real quick,
make your last point,
and
then
we'll
it's a crowded day. Yeah, go ahead.
The lawsuit that I referred to
that with her friend Christine Brim is the chief judge, and this kind of a lawsuit, usually the chief judge will sign it for themselves, is Penny Asgarati, a military veteran who is very no-nonsense. I mean,
right.
If I've been in front of her, if she wants to yell at me or yell at the other side, you know, she's a straight shooter and and does not pull her punches. So hopefully it will get assigned as it would normally would to the chief judge, and that will be treated very right down the middle.
Interesting.
All right, so.
All right, we're going to take 2 minutes.
Go ahead.
I want to go to Claire on our favorite place, China, Taiwan, and the strategic situation there, and why our intelligence agencies were surprised by a hypersonic missile. We talked about that with Dr. Peter Pry Monday, you know, fairly extensively, the nature of the intelligence agencies. Of course, Afghanistan, I want to know why, you know, hold on just a second. I want to know why we didn't, we know we left our weapons there, why we didn't go get them back, and why we didn't take a whole bunch of these Afghanis back and then bring our Americans home. And then we had one more. Who wants to make what? Was that Bianchi?
Well, it's got to be something wrong with that. When you go through using technology to find out who didn't vote and who's not registered, then you get them to get registered, plus you tell them who to vote for.
Yeah.
It's something wrong with that.
Well, that's the question that, that Claire was saying. It's nefarious but not illegal. So there's a lot of things that are legal that are really disgusting. It's just, you know, but there's that fine line. Anyway, let me play this because we have a new webmaster who's doing wonders with our Write Your Laws website. Back in 2 minutes with Claire. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with a personal recommendation and testimonial for Eric Colley, our new webmaster and marketing guru. Eric has been invaluable in upgrading our website, writeyourlaws.com. To help you with your marketing, Eric Colley offers proven, cost-effective strategies to help small businesses, startups, and nonprofits market themselves on Google Page One. You can gain thousands of followers and be far more competitive, and this is the good part, without paid advertising. Most business owners don't have the time or expertise to excel at marketing. Even fewer have the funds to hire a special employee. And you don't have to. There is a better option. Eric Colley, a consultant who uses leading-edge marketing strategies to increase your profitability at costs which are far more affordable than an advertising or marketing agency. You can be seen high up in Google's Page One. You can dominate Google's local three-pack of businesses next to the search results map. You can be trusted as much as personal recommendations from family and friends. You can increase foot and website traffic. You can do all this, all without paying Google, Facebook, or Instagram one red cent. Eric Colley can be reached at 208-999-7510. That's 208-999-7510. His website is besmallbusiness.com. That's besmallbusiness.com, B-E-S-M-A-L-L-B-U-S-I-N-E-S-S, besmallbusiness.com. And you can reach him by email at eric@besmallbusiness.com. And that's how you do it. Yeah, we're looking at some explosive growth in Action Radio this year, so it's going to be 2022 is going to be really exciting around here because of folks that are coming to us now that are helping out and fixing websites like Eric's doing and other things that that I can't tell you about yet. But trust me, this stuff in the works. Claire, let's go to the big debacle in China. And why were they surprised? I'm always surprised that our intelligence communities are surprised. I'm shocked that they're surprised. I'm disgusted that they're surprised.
Well,
why are they surprised? Why didn't they know?
They weren't
stuff?
Surprised. They knew perfectly well what China was doing. They weren't surprised.
Okay.
I don't know why those quote-unquote anonymous sources would have said so, and they made such statements to the media, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And they also claimed to the media that we have no defenses against the missiles. That part's probably true. But the fact that they did not know that China was developing nuclear-capable hypersonic cruise missiles, of course they knew.
Would that be human intelligence on the ground, satellite technology, national
reconnaissance, I have no idea.
Stuff,
no idea
all of the
how,
above?
But
okay.
There's no way they did not know this.
Okay.
For one thing, we have shared hypersonic cruise missile technology with the Chinese in past years. So, hello. Of course they do.
So, in fact, I think I sent you a story, Honeywell. This is about 6 months old. Honeywell was sharing, illegally sharing technology on some of our most advanced jets, F-21,
yeah,
F-35.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Okay, so let's go into details about that. How is that possible? Why do they think that's a benefit? Why aren't they all in jail? What's going on?
It's not a benefit
why are they...
to anybody except their bottom line. this isn't about the benefit to the United States of America's national security. Mm-hmm. That's not what anybody is in this for.
You know, you'd think the companies would have a little loyalty to this country, but, you know, maybe a crazy question. But just to let folks know the article, it's in Aerospace, Intelligent Aerospace, and this is from June 7th. And they don't give an author to the article here, but they say this week the U.S. State Department announced it had concluded a $13 million administrative settlement. $13 million, that's for Honeywell. That's like lunch money, you know, with Honeywell International Inc., following allegations that the American defense contractor had illegally exported technical drawings of parts for multiple aircraft, including Lockheed Martin's F-22 Raptor, F-35 Lightning II, which I think is a turkey, but that's another story. According to the complaint, company officials sent multiple engineering and technical documents to China over a multi-year period. Isn't that spying? there's got to be something, you know, 50
well,
million?
Certainly violating national security export regulations, and that's why they got caught and fined.
Yeah. So now we're going to see, but the $13 million for Honeywell, that's nothing.
Yeah, as you say, lunch money. Yeah.
That's
not meaningful at all.
You know,
nor
people,
much of a deterrent to future misbehavior.
Well, here's the problem. We might have soldiers that have to, and pilots and sailors that have to go up against China, and Honeywell's giving them our airplane technical drawings. You know, why is this just isn't there any move in Washington to condemn more of this? I mean, where are the geldings? Where are the Republicans? Where is somebody screaming and yelling? Because if they're doing this, they're only getting $13 million. That's what I call cost of doing business. So how much did they make from China for those drawings? Do you have any way to find that out? Or have you heard anything about this?
No, I don't know any more of the specifics about Honeywell or any of the other high-tech companies. But, you know, there was a time dating back to the 1970s and forward when it was thought by many in industry, in government, in academia, that opening up to China was a good idea and that it would draw China into the world community of nations and that commercial connections and commercial opportunities for China, World Trade Organization and so forth, would inevitably lead to a liberalization in their government, the Chinese Communist Party. Well, you know, duh, that didn't work out very well. But it's too late now because during the honeymoon period, an awful lot was shared with China, and it's too late to pull it back now. They've got it.
Yeah. Don't they also
in addition
have a policy?
To all the other
all right, go ahead.
Intellectual
yeah.
property thefts. That they commit, the Chinese Communist Party, commits over the years.
Well, they just simply steal it from our colleges and other folks. And they're just Americans now, I don't think, have the loyalty that we had, you know, certainly the World War II generation or even after that, to not give, you know, our greatest secrets, you know, to sell out our country for however many dollars they get. You know, we have to make the cost of doing this far greater than the $13 million. People need to go to jail. They need to be personally fined. The companies need to be seized. I mean, I'm a big fan of asset forfeiture for stuff, and this might be something that would be interesting to look at. But I heard before that China, and I don't know if you know this, they used to have a policy where, like Boeing, if Boeing wanted to sell aircraft to China Airlines back, I think it was like the 80s, I think I first heard about this, that Boeing would go in, and they'd sell like 5 or 10 airliners. And then as part of the deal, China said, okay, great, but we want the technical, you know, specs of your airplanes just to make sure everything's correct and wonderful and fine, and we want to check it all out. But what they were really doing was taking all the plants so they could build their own airliners. They'd reverse engineer them. And
oh,
that's
sure.
why a lot
they
of Chinese
did this
airliners...
with all kinds of They did this with all kinds of technology. It wasn't just airplanes.
Right.
It was every kind of technology you can think of, and every business that wanted to do business in China had this choice put before them. Either you give us your intellectual property, the specs, the technological details, or no business in China. That's what's been going on for decades across the board. It's very well known.
Yeah, that's confirmation. I mean, I heard it, but I hadn't really had it confirmed, you know, as absolutely. So then that raises the question, why, you know, obviously they know the Western character that the bottom line quarterly profit, you know, it shows an increase, you know, even if they are selling out their company and selling out their products, is different than the Chinese philosophy. They're looking 100 years ahead. So they're strategically marketing. They're playing chess around the world, and we've got companies that are you know, looking for an increase for the next quarter.
Yeah,
that
no, they're not playing
difference.
Chess. They're playing Wei Qi.
Oh, what's Wei Qi?
You know, the board game with the little stones.
Backgammon, no? Or is it different? No, I think it's something
different.
No. What's Wei Qi?
Okay,
I'm not familiar with Wei Qi.
So Wei Qi, W-E-I-Q-I, Wei Qi.
Uh-huh. Okay.
In Japanese, it's sometimes called Go.
Oh,
it's
I know what
a board
that
game,
okay. Yeah.
Played between two opponents.
Right.
Each side has a little set of stones, a set of little stones. One side is black stones. One side is white stones.
Okay.
And the object of the game, through regulated moves, according to the rules of the game, is that each side tries to surround and marginalize the opponent by stones on the board. So it's not like chess, you know, where you're knocking off the rook and there goes the castle and now I'm going for the queen and we're going to knock him off the board. Okay, that's chess.
Mm-hmm.
This is not like that. This is very much more in line with Chinese thinking and philosophy and, you know, the philosophy of centuries of Sun Tzu and art of war.
Yeah,
you
move strategically.
Okay. And you marginalize the enemy before ever a shot is fired. That's why it's illustrative. The game, Wei Qi, is illustrative of the way China and the Chinese Communist Party conduct international relations, including business.
And so all the stones, this is fascinating, this is why I love having you on. So the stones in Wei Qi or Go, they're all equal in power. So it's all based on position.
Well, it's movement. Yeah, there are circumscribed rules of the game and how you can move your stones, and each side gets a turn, you know, and the stones flow and they move. They're not marching across the board to knock off the king. That's chess.
Right.
Which is a complex game. I don't mean to minimize it. It's complex and sophisticated in its own right.
And it has
but it's a difference of philosophy and thinking about how opponents gain the upper hand against adversaries.
Okay. Now, I'm assuming that our intelligence officials don't play Wei Qi? Or they don't think in terms of that?
I don't even know what it is.
See, this is you know... one of the advantages that I believe I have, having grown up in three different countries, is that I've seen people as people see themselves. I was able to see Canadians from Australia. I was able to see, you know, Australians from the United States. And I was able to see the United States, you know, just by having virtue of learning how to see other people see themselves. And the first thing I know, if I want to get to know another country, because I was forced to, is to see people as they see themselves. So I had to understand Americans as Americans understand themselves. So the first thing I would do, thinking in my brain, if I was going to study China, this is exactly the kind of thing I'd be looking into. What are their games? How do they amuse themselves? What is their culture? What is their philosophy? What is their history?
Well,
have they been dominated
thousands
by
of
leaders?
Years old,
yeah.
By the way.
Okay. Okay.
Thousands.
Huh.
It's very simple. All you need is a board with squares on it and the colored stones. I mean, it's a very simple game.
Yeah, you could draw something on the ground. You could actually make your own. How many squares?
I don't know.
Because, you know, I'm curious.
I'm
going to have to look
this
up. I'm going to look it up, exactly. Well, let's get Bianchi's back on the line here, too. And Bianchi, is there an equivalent?
Yeah, that game is called...
go ahead.
That game is called AlphaGo. And the top person that was expertise in it was a Korean who played IBM at Blue. And the IBM AI that's called Blue beat him. But, you know, there's another source of information that gives you the idea behind China's move, and not only China but others, but it's a book that's called Tribes, T-R-I-B-E-S. The author is Jewel Coatling, the subtitle is How Race, Culture, and Ethnicity Equates to World Success, something like that. China's been at this for a long time, and well, that is how they play.
You know, and it's funny, I don't think of China as a race. You know, we think of Asians as a race. Does China think of themselves as a unique people equivalent of a race?
Absolutely so. The okay. Han Chinese are the dominant people, the dominant ethnic group in the Chinese okay. Communist Party. I mean, if you go back and look at history in the Asian landmass, you find that it is the Chinese, or it is the Han Chinese ethnic group that conquered and dominated all the rest. They conquered the Manchus, they conquered the Mongols, they conquered the Tibetans.
Mm-hmm.
So very much, they're very, very extremely conscious of race and racist. Yes.
But not in terms that we think of race in terms of skin color, which I don't buy the definition of race anyway.
Oh, very much
but,
they do.
Oh, it is skin color? Are there different skin colors in China based on...
Although I'm not saying that the Manchus or the Mongols or the Tibetans are very much different in skin color, but on a global scale, what I'm saying is
right.
that the CCP and the Han Chinese are deeply racist.
Are the communists, Mao Zedong, was he a Han dynasty person?
He came out of another province of China, but definitely, certainly, he's the one who conquered China in modern times, the landmass.
Right.
But what I will say is that once Mao Zedong and his number two, Zhou Enlai, took power,
mm-hmm.
And from the 1960s onward, there was a very, very close relationship with the black revolutionaries, the Black Panthers of the time, up until the mid-70s when both Mao and Zhou Enlai died.
Mm-hmm.
Leading revolutionaries of the Black Panthers like Huey P. Newton, Stokely Carmichael, Elizabeth Brown, on and on,
mm-hmm.
made multiple trips to Beijing. And we know this because they were photo ops and we have the photographs of them meeting with the top leadership of the CCP at the time. And it is that connection that carries on to this day, at least ideologically speaking, with the Black Lives Matter movement and the close relationship between the CCP and the BLM. Just fun fact.
Are they funding the BLM? Because Black Lives Matter has
certainly.
Billions of dollars.
At least in
okay.
part. We okay. know this from certain websites like... have come to light between the Chinese Progressive Association, which has bases in both the East Coast, Boston area, and West Coast, San Francisco, which on the website of the Black Futures Lab, that's it, Black Futures Lab,
okay.
Openly declares, if you hit the donate button, that it is the Chinese Progressive Association that has the financial relationship with Black Futures Lab, which is a subsidiary of the Black Lives Matter movement under Alicia Garza, one of the founders of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah, we haven't heard a whole lot from them lately,
which
makes me suspicious. And Piaki, might you make a point? And then I got Kyle from Sacramento who's calling in California, so we'll get to him in a second. Go ahead, Piaki.
Yeah, Claire, that relationships between the new Black Panther Party and the communists may, I'm not sure, may also continue to exist, too.
Did the Communist Party resurrect
them? What happened recently, they're a little more circumspect now. You don't have the delegations going over there as in the late 60s, early 70s for photo ops with Xi Jinping. You don't have that. But what you have instead is a Chinese Communist Party representation through its diplomatic missions, and there are many, on U.S. soil, and they operate out of those consulates in particular to collude with our media and with the Black Lives Matter movement and so forth. And then, of course, through the United Front Work Department with all of our major entities. But it's more circumspect. It's a little more sophisticated than direct delegations going over there, as in the past.
Well, they can hold a Zoom meeting. We'd never know it. you know, because this is the age of technology. They don't have to go over to meet. You know, it's a whole different world here. Is this like I said? Whenever I don't hear about somebody, I start to worry about what they're doing. Is given what we said earlier about China working with Dr. McClure, and given they're wanting to, you know, keep the election their way, so that they have their, you know, who I'm calling the Chinese ambassador, Joe Biden. Do you think they're setting up 2022 and 2024 using Black Lives Matter in some way that we're going to see in a little bit? And then I'll get to Kyle's question.
Well, I'll tell you very quickly what happened in the past and why in the middle of 2020, then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo closed down China's Houston consulate. And it wasn't only for espionage and intellectual property theft, because that goes on through all of the different consulates, which include New York City, Chicago, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, which remain open. But rather, in Houston, what had happened, and we find this, or at least I found this, through Radio Free Asia and a translation of it, is that the Communist Party of China sent a PLA, People's Liberation Army, unit undercover to the Houston consulate. And their job was to compile a list of Americans they thought, through data mining and AI, a list of Americans they thought would be sympathetic to the Black Lives Matter movement and Antifa street rioting. They compiled the list, and then what they did is created TikTok videos. By the way, do not ever, ever click or touch on a TikTok video. It is an AI data mining CCP collection platform. They made TikTok videos, and they pushed the TikTok videos out to their list that they had previously drawn up, with instructions on how to get involved in street protest and rioting. That's what they did on U.S. soil, operating out of the Houston consulate. And I believe, my opinion, is that that is why Secretary Pompeo closed that consulate down but left the others open.
Fascinating. So as far as it goes, I see TikTok videos on Facebook. I don't even want to click on those. Is that connected, or do you have to have an app?
Don't ever. Ever. Okay. If you can see the little TikTok logo, just get away from it as fast as possible.
Yeah. Well, China's already banned us. We used to have listeners in China and Taiwan. It's fascinating that they both dropped at the same time, dropped off our international listener map. Let's get Kyle, who I haven't heard from for a while, see if he has a question. So, Kyle, welcome back to the show. You're on with Claire Lopez. We're talking foreign intelligence and foreign affairs.
This is awesome. This is awesome. Yeah. And I blinked out a little bit because I just had an invader come into my apartment area. I live in Sacramento, California, as you know, Greg, and some nice person just decided to come in his bicycle and slam the gate and so forth. And it's 5 to 7 here in Sacramento, California, and it's slightly raining. It's dark. And so anyway, I told the guy that, you know what, get the hell, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
So I got distracted. but I got the gist of it, and I want to ask her 3 quick questions. I'm sure she can answer them quicker than
not.
We've
got about 8 minutes left. But you're welcome to call back.
Go ahead.
So, you know, go ahead, Kyle.
Social media is the safest to listen to? BLM, you're saying that basically China is backing that? Wow. And Qi, I was told, is actually pronounced C. Is that true? And or is C a member, or Qi, the leader of China, a member of this predominant color in China?
Yes.
Kind of like
Xi
white
Jinping
is the predominant
and
color
yeah.
in America.
The X in XI, Xi Jinping, is pronounced Xi. Yes, he is Han Chinese. The dominant ethnic group, beyond which he's the top 0.01% of the most brilliant people in China, because you don't get to the tippy top except by meritocracy in China and intellectual prowess. Your middle question was China supporting the BLM. Yes, absolutely. And if you go to the Black Futures Lab website and hit the donate button, I haven't done it in a while, but the last time I did do it, takes you to a page that says the Chinese Progressive Association financially supports and backs the Black Futures Lab, which is a project of the Black Lives Matter movement under the network run by Alicia Garza. And then I forgot your first question.
No, that's all right. I'll ask it again. But what percentage would you say BLM is of the Chinese? Are they half behind it, a third behind it, two-thirds behind it?
I couldn't say. I really don't know that. I mean,
okay,
there's
and
a
then
lot
my
of
other question.
Input. I mean, I would even say it's probably minimal, because the vast majority of the financial support for Black Lives Matter movement comes from U.S. air quotes, philanthropic foundations like Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, Tides Foundation, Plowshares Foundation, on and on and on. That's
so
where
it's
big
not,
money
it's,
comes
it's,
from for
it's,
Black Lives Matter
movement. It's globalist money or sick
yes.
money or evil money more than Democrats.
Well, I would say it's these left-leaning, leftist, progressive, communist-leaning foundations that and
right,
they are globalist indeed.
Right. A lot of the things you mentioned, though, Rockefellers to Fords to big names, a lot of people associate with big money and power and Republicans.
Yeah. Well,
so
it could be
both. Everybody.
Yes, yes. I mean, we're talking a uniparty. There aren't two parties. It's a uniparty.
Right. Okay, I agree. So the other thing you have made very clear to me, and I think I'm summing things up for your audience here because I got in late. TikTok bad. I get that. TikTok
uh-huh.
bad. Don't
oh, yeah,
don't
yeah.
do
what,
it.
What's good?
Of the social media, if I'm addicted to Facebook, do I stay on Facebook in your
well,
opinion, or do I
know,
go to like there's
hold
a truth
on,
one
hold
I just saw.
I am still
on Twitter at Claire M. Lopez. Welcome any new followers at Claire M. Lopez. I'm on Facebook, the same thing, my own name. I use Telegram, and then I also use other applications like Signal, which is not social media per se, but it's communication.
What's the best email? Now that we're on this subject, and then I actually clicked Black Futures.
Pardon,
now I got that. I'll
say
tell you
there,
in
Greg?
A second. What's the best
email?
Most
secure
email.
Oh, email. Proton. Use Proton.
Okay.
There are others.
What do you
mean
Proton?
You can install VPN over, huh?
How do you do Proton? How does a moron know what Proton is?
You just download it for free off the internet. Protonmail.com.
Proton
mail.
Yeah.
Just
okay.
Free download. Just yeah, I mean you can
yep.
you can pay for upgrades to have, you know, snazzier versions, but the basic you know, email
right.
is free download.
Yeah.
Let me
jump in here for a second because I went to the Black Futures Lab and I clicked on donate and it says support Black Futures Lab and then it says here Black Futures Lab is in italics is a fiscally sponsored project of the Chinese Progressive Association. CPA is
go.
A 501c3. Wait, but here's the thing that killed me. They're tax exempt. They're not nonprofit. How the hell do they get that? The Chinese Progressive Association is a nonprofit. Registered here in our country?
Well, can
what's wrong
can
with,
I,
what's wrong
Coast
with that
West
picture?
Coast.
Yeah. Go ahead, Kyle.
Can I remind the audience or you, Greg, that I joined the ECOS, the Environmental Council of Sacramento, which sounds very pure, and it's,
uh-huh.
I'm surely it's nonprofit, Environmental Council of Sacramento. After joining that club for a month, you know, I was very proper, didn't say much. Second time, same thing. Third month, same
right.
thing. Fourth time, they give us a packet of these. Every project, this packet was an inch thick, and it's a piece of paper, right? Each piece. So there's that many
right.
projects in Sacramento. I said, which ones are we against, right? I asked the Environmental Council of Sacramento. I'm sitting in this office with eight, you know, guys sitting around a round table, acting as though they care about the environment of Council
right.
of Sacramento. Sacramento.
Cut to the
and
chase.
Each one of them were in on it. One guy worked
yeah.
for the developer in town. One guy worked for the landscaper. It was all BS. And so then I asked the guy, I said, now, if I'm actually, because then I talked to the head of Environmental Council Sacramento. I said, you know, Bob, let's call him Bob. It was about 2 years ago. Can't remember his name. I go, Bob, what organization would I join if I actually care? Long story short. He said the Sierra Club. Now, are you ready for this? The Sierra Club finally asked me for my payment renewal, and I've been a member since 2011, stupidly giving them $35 a month. I finally asked them
$35
this
a month? You could donate that to Action Radio, dude.
I mean a year.
You better
spend. I'm sorry.
Okay, I'll take that,
nice
too.
Nice call. You're a great listener. No. So $35 a year. So I asked them, I said, can you tell me what your top five people are paid and what two projects you're working on? Do you think the guy called me back?
No.
Answer's
yeah.
no. So I called them back. I asked another lady. I said, excuse me, ma'am, maybe I got this wrong to the first guy, you know, knowing the answer. Can you tell me what your top five people are paid to this nonprofit Sierra Club, right, and or whatever it's called? And I said, what are the two projects you're working on? Do you think she called me back?
You yeah. could probably find that information online, but remember back to the Cold War years, all the peace now movements, they were KGB front groups.
So this is my next question. Is the penetration of the environmental group? We got 90 seconds left. So, Claire, if you can just – great question, Kyle. But how much is the environmental groups tied in with the Chinese Communist Party? We may have to pick up next week.
I don't know, but that's a subject for some good research.
Okay. So who is, so which groups are you saying? So you're saying the KGB was originally associated? So that's Russian.
I'm talking about the Cold War years and all the Peace Now movements.
Peace Now movements
I'm
is all
Russian.
I'm
drawing an analogy here.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I understand that. I'm trying to – I got a minute. I want to get as much as I can in. So this is common. Well, here's the last question. How much, is black about Black Lives Matter other than the figureheads at the front of it? I guess Kyle likes that question.
Sorry.
Claire, is there anything black about Black Lives Matter other than the
is
people
Is there
that
anything
we've seen?
Real about anything today?
Well, that's for another show. Claire, you want to tackle that one or no? Or should we just save that one?
I will leave it to the response of the previous speaker, Laffer.
Okay. Well, listen, Kyle, you should call earlier because we have Claire on every Thursday. And
She's good.
She's very
you are
good.
Clear
yeah.
and concise. And I know Greg is good, clear and concise. So, wow,
oh,
yeah.
You.
The amount of information that was shared in this time was amazing.
I just need to get your story shorter, your question shorter for next time so we can get more answer. That's all right. Listen, everybody, it's been a fabulous day. We've got 3 hours today. Just go back to the podcast. I'll have show notes for everybody. You can listen to this just amazing show on today. So thank you, Kyle and Claire and Jonathan and Jean and Pianchi and Josie and Wallace and Cindy from the first hour. This is I'm so glad I went 3 hours. All right, we'll do it again tomorrow. 6 o'clock in the morning Central Time, 7 o'clock Eastern Time, and of course, Kyle, if he's awake, 4 o'clock in the morning Pacific Time. Greg Pangos for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. We will see you again tomorrow.
Have a great day.
Thanks, Gene.